You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Dan Kovalik. Daniel Kovalik is the author of the recently released book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. Dan Kovalik teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He has worked on Alien Tort Claims Act cases against the Coca-Cola Company and Occidental Petroleum, cases arising out of egregious human rights abuses in Colombia. The Christian Science Monitor referred to his work defending Colombian unionists under the threat of assassination, recently describing Mr. Kovalik as, quote, one of the most prominent defenders of Colombian workers in the United States. Dan Kovalik, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks, David. I really appreciate it.
Very glad to have you on. So why switch to the topic of Russia? What is it about what's going on now with Russia?
Yes, well, in fact, all my friends do ask me that, as you read in my bio. I've mostly focused on Latin America. But I have been concerned for a number of years, well before the 2016 election campaign, of what I see and others see as the new Cold War with Russia that's been brewing. You know, I grew up in I was politically aware in the late 70s and in the 80s when the Cold War was still raging, though, of course, then it came to a precipitous end. And by the end, I had changed my views on the Cold War. I had been grown up in a Cold War household, very anti-communist household. And I, as time went on, I came to have much a different view of Russia in the world, and to not view it as an enemy. And frankly, I've carried that with me. And now that I see they're being portrayed as this enemy, I think quite unfairly, I do feel a need to come to the defense of Russia, and frankly, to oppose a possible next war with them.
Yeah. Did the Cold War end, or did one side of the Cold War end? I mean, in terms.
Well, that's a great question, and I'm sure historians will debate this for a long time. I think that there might have been a short hiatus period in which, during the Yeltsin years, the U.S. Was okay with Russia as is. You know, when Yeltsin allowed the country to be plundered by all parties, but then that hiatus ended pretty quickly, and then the Cold War, but a different type of Cold War, not based on anti-communism, obviously, anymore, emerged. So I guess I would say maybe there's two distinct Cold Wars, but given the old Cold War, it's very easy to to encourage Americans to hate Russia. You know, Eric Hobsbawm, the historian, said the hatred of Russia is in the DNA of the American people, and that's very true. So I think they were an easy target once we decided they were a problem again.
Or once somebody did, I didn't.
Yeah, not us. I always say we, and I shouldn't do that. I understand. It's my Catholic guilt thing, I think. But.
So I wanted to talk to you about the latest little piece of propaganda in this, what you call the plot to scapegoat Russia, and that is this video with Morgan Freeman, an actor, telling us a fictional story that is apparently a political statement of fact in the mind of many viewers. I don't want to play the thing. I find it too revolting. But can you describe for people so that they don't have to watch it what this video is?
Yeah, well, it's on the par of like a 1950s propaganda film, like Reefer Madness or something. And he just opens it. I think the opening lines are very important. He says, "We have been attacked. We are at war." And they show you scenes of Soviet soldiers marching on Red Square. and he talks about a KGB agent who he never names, but we know it's Putin. They do show a video of Putin, who rises through the ranks, becomes president. He's upset that Russia is on its knees, and now he's going to seek revenge against his sworn enemy. Again, these are Morgan Freeman's words, the United States. And that we, you know, he does call on Trump to investigate and find out what Russia did and stop, you know, Russia from doing it again. He barely ever says, of course, what Russia ever did or is claimed to have done. But it's a really incredible piece. It's about as extreme case of yellow journalism that I've seen in a long time.
And you know, there has, of course, as you know, and many of our listeners will know, been a wide range of claims about what Russia supposedly done, many of them summarized in the vague term, hacked the U.S. election. But what if all of those claims were true? Wouldn't it still be rather dangerous to declare your country to be at war? Isn't war something a little bit different that involves weaponry and large numbers of deaths?
Yes, yes. Well, it shows a few things. I mean, first of all, it shows a tone deafness as to what war is. I mean, to say that we're at war, as you say, we're not at war, not yet. I think most Americans, though, don't know what war is because we have barely suffered it. Certainly, we have never suffered it in the way the Russians did in World War II, that Europe did in World War II. And we've been very fortunate in that way. But I think it makes us less empathetic about what wars do to people. And to claim that there's a war, frankly, is an insult to people who suffer from war. But also, it's dangerous because by saying we're at war, it's really declaring a war on another country, and by people like a Morgan Freeman, who literally people think is God, right? He plays God in the movies, you know. Right. It's very manipulative and very dangerous. And, of course, Russia's still a nuclear power. But you do see, even aside from the Morgan Freeman video, you see Congress people on both sides of the aisle. You see commentators who say we've been attacked through these, again, amorphous allegations of election hacking, and say that a military response is in order. So there are people in power who seem to want a war with Russia, and it's just crazy. And again, it appears that Morgan Freeman and Robert Reiner, who, of course, you might remember was Meathead, the liberal on Archie Bunker, you know, that he would seem to be calling for a war on Russia, is it just shows where this country's at right now, and it's not a pretty place.
Now, you mentioned Rob Reiner, who's not in the video. Where did this video come from? The Committee to Investigate Russia, what is that?
Yeah, well, I guess I don't know for sure what it is, but it's some organization, which again sounds like McCarthy's House Un-American Committee, but it's some committee with the Rob Reiner's on, James Clapper, a couple other, frankly, right-wing.
Max Boot.
Yeah, Max Boot. Another guy.
Norman Ornstein.
Right. David Froom at least has some association with it. So it's some group, the self-proclaimed group, that wants to investigate Russia, I guess, for its alleged election meddling. I note it's very interesting because, of course, you know, the Democrats and Rob Reiner is a prominent Democrat, certainly, and Morgan Freeman is too. They'll obviously want to use the Russiagate scandal to undermine Trump, which at least I understand those intentions. But the interesting thing is it's not the committee to investigate Trump. It's just the committee to investigate Russia. So, I mean, the suggestion is almost we don't care even about Trump. What we care about is going after Russia, you know, which it makes it even more dangerous, I think. I do think, again, ultimately the desire is to use this to undermine Trump as president, which, again, I'm not a Trump supporter, and I'm all fine for undermining him, but frankly not in a way or not through means that, one, are false and misleading, but also more to the point, which could lead to, you know, World War III, you know, which, again, they seem to be eager to do somehow.
Indeed. We're speaking with Daniel Kovalik, who is the author of the recently released book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. And we just noted James Clapper is on the board of this committee to investigate Russia. Dan, in terms of motivations, it seems like there are a number of possible motivations, including profit. Cold War with Russia is incredibly profitable for weapons dealers and campaign funders. Politics, it's, you know, something that the Democrats want to play up. But it seems to me like going after Trump needs a little elaboration. I think, it looks to me like going after Trump with the one thing that can demonize him but not actually hurt him, with the one thing that needs an investigation, with the one thing, you know, it's not like the illegal wars or the ban on Muslims or the sexual assault or the incitement of violence or the financial corruption in violation of the emoluments clauses or, you know, any of the dozens of publicly documented high crimes and misdemeanors. It's like they want to pick the one thing that can make Trump look bad and the Democrats look good without doing anything other than not being Trump. But they don't want to go after something that, you know, that he could actually be impeached and removed from office for.
You raise a good point. In essence, this red baiting is nothing but a red herring. I think part of it is, and it's an interesting, you know, thing we have to evaluate, but I think one of the problems that the Democrats have is that a lot of the terrible things Trump is doing, they have done themselves. Obama did himself. You know, Obama, you know, to remind folks, deported 2.5 million people, more than all the presidents before him combined. He waged seven wars in the Middle East. He destroyed Libya. He helped solidify the coup in Honduras in 2009. You know, a lot of what could be said about Trump could also be said about Obama and the Democrats. And so I think they're trying to pick an issue that doesn't reflect back on them poorly, right? So they pick an issue that allows the system to continue grinding in the way it has been through all the presidents, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. And that's what's troubling to me most about what I see is the so-called resistance to Trump, even in the rank and file progressive community, that while there is very good work being done against police violence and against racism, which are great things and should be done, there's very little agitation against war and against, mass killings like in Yemen that the U.S. is supporting. And it's a bit interesting, but I think the Russiagate scandal is a perfect way to continue to promote war but also attack Trump. And so those who resist Trump almost veer away from the issue because they're now so motivated against Russia that war almost seems to be a virtuous thing. And that's, of course, the whole problem that this country has labored under for so long, that it is war all the time, and it doesn't matter who the president is. And our country, even the populace, has become very inured to it and very accepting of it.
Indeed, it's an excellent point, and I certainly have friends and allies who will not go after Trump for the same things they would go after Bush for, because they chose not to say a word when Obama was doing those things. But I still think there are exceptions. There's financial corruption with Trump that is unique and unprecedented, and could be gone after if it were, you know, a topic of interest to the Democrats.
And even if I could just add one thing, even if folks want to go after the election misdeeds, why aren't they going after, you know, what Greg Palast has been talking about, this cross-check system, which kicked thousands and thousands, maybe a million people off the voter rolls, and which probably did impact the election in favor of Trump. And yet no one's talking about that. And that's actually something we could fix, right?
Indeed.
So it's all about a sleight of hand, as you say, focusing on something out there that frankly we have little impact on and that will have little impact. But it seems like we're now in a mode where we deal in symbols more than we deal with real issues. You know, even when we deal, frankly, with anti-racism, a lot of it is dealing with symbolic things. Meanwhile, you have slaves that are being openly trafficked in Libya because of our war there. We did that. There are real slaves now being, sold in markets in Libya. And yet, where is the discussion on that?
But even setting things into proper context, and even understanding that the U.S. election system could hardly be more broken, more financially corrupted, is voter suppression, voter intimidation, the voter IDs requirements, just countless ways in which the communication system and the election system are corrupted, so that one more, you know, isn't a switch from good to bad, and understanding that the United States is, you know, interfered in at least 80 some elections we know of, and countless coups directly and through trainees, and bombed over 30 countries in the past 75 years and so forth. Put everything into context, the question still remains, what, if anything, did Russia do? How do you answer that?
Well, I agree with John Pilger, who said that the Russiagate scandal is not only devoid of evidence, it's actually devoid of allegations. It's hard to even pin down what they're claiming. But, I mean, when you go down to the, you know, to the nuts and bolts of what claims are there, you have the claim that Russia hacked the DNC computer and brought forth emails that truthfully showed that how corrupt the Democrats are. That's an allegation, which I think has been unproven, but that's a claim.
And which is a favor to us if we want to know what our political system is doing, right?
Yeah, and again, a minor infraction, truthfully, given the things you say, given the infractions the U.S. has made in terms of literally militarily overthrowing other governments. And now you have this claim that maybe possibly a Russian company that maybe possibly had some relationship with the Russian government bought $100,000 in Facebook ads before and after the election that didn't really talk about the election but dealt with some hot-button issues. I mean, again, I just can't imagine that people feel alarmed by this. There are companies that spend $100,000 a day on Facebook ads. Trump spent $84 million on Facebook ads. And we're to believe that $100,000 in Facebook ads over a period of over a year had any bearing on the election? And then meanwhile, we don't even know that it was a Russian company behind it, and yet this is making the front page of the Washington Post. This is a nothing burger. I'm sorry, I have no other word for it. I mean, this is silliness, and yet you have the media focused on it 24 hours a day. Meanwhile, it doesn't seem, though, the polls seem to suggest that that even rank and file Democrats are not that interested in this issue, that they care more about health care, jobs, you know, about their communities, about their health and better health care, than they care about this Russiagate scandal, you know. And frankly, even from a tactical point of view, if this is all the Democrats got, they probably will not make many gains in 2018. And well, and it's been proven because they've lost the first four special elections out of the gate after Trump was elected, because all they got is this Russiagate nonsense. It's an excuse not to deal with real issues, as you say, and it's also an excuse for losing to Trump, which obviously is an embarrassment. Anyone should be embarrassed by that. But it calls for, you know, more self-reflection as a party and as a people, and not to blame, you know, a third country for maybe possibly buying Facebook ads. I mean, it's just incredible to me.
And how do you explain so many people so blissfully going along with what seem like contradictory statements or demands, including Morgan Freeman? You know, on the one hand, we know Russia did this evil thing that amounts to war. And on the other hand, we need an investigation to find out what, if anything, Russia did. I don't – how do those fit together in the same mental space?
Well, unfortunately, I think that's how most of our wars are prosecuted, right? We fire first and then ask questions later. I mean, that is it's a ready, fire, aim. I think our country's used to that. Again, you know, you look at the Iraq War. You know, there is no proof of weapons of mass destruction. In fact, we were being told by very authoritative people there weren't any, and yet no one bothered for any proof before we went in, and it turns out, of course, there were no weapons of mass destruction a million Iraqis later. You know, and it's interesting because as a lawyer, and I talk about this, I'm a lawyer, you know, and so we talk about burdens of proof. And the higher the stakes, the greater the burden of proof, right? If you're going to go to jail or maybe be put to death, the prosecutor has to prove your guilt, you know, with a high level of evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. And I would assert, if you're going to make claims that could lead to war with another country, you need at least as high of a burden of proof. And yet Americans seem to desire almost no proof before we engage in conflict.
But haven't they got us then and now asking the wrong questions and searching for the wrong answers? I mean, even if every single claim about Iraqi weapons were true, the United States openly had all of those same weapons, and there's nothing legal, moral, strategic to justify attacking either country. Even if all these claims about Russia were true, they don't constitute war or a justification for war, legal, moral, or otherwise, do they? So don't we have to prove all the factual errors and then point out that it's the wrong conversation to begin with?
Well, you raise the very key point. You're absolutely correct. You know, I teach international human rights, and the one thing I talk about over and over is that there is a concept you know, in which we look at, is a war justified? Is it just? Before we even talk about how a war should be prosecuted, you know, what rights should be protected during war, we never talk about the first question, and about very few human rights organizations do. But you're right. The first question is, even if everything we say about Russia is true, does it justify war? And of course, I would argue, and I think you would agree, it doesn't even come close to justifying it. And yet, people seem to believe, again, they've jumped to the conclusion already that possibly war is justified against Russia. And if you ask people why, they could barely tell you why.
But I have a theory that we have just a few minutes left. I have a theory that when Russia fell out of its position as the justification for wars around the world at the close of the earlier Cold War, that, you know, a new replacement was sought and found in terrorism, in Middle Eastern terrorism. It could never end. It would be with us forever. It was a bet, you know, it was going to work better than the Soviet menace. But that's been weakened in recent years, that people are are not as scared of Middle Eastern terrorism as they were at first, and that Russia is being brought back as a better justification for military spending.
Well, yes. In fact, I'll see you and raise you one on that. Not only are the terrorists, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, not viewed as a threat, in fact, there are segments of the military and people in power who view them as the ally and are using them as an ally. They did that in Libya. They're doing that in Syria. I mean, the fact is they needed to switch gears because they decided they'd rather partner with these extremists as they did with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and they're doing now, then see a stable Middle East. And so, therefore, terrorism couldn't be the reason for war. So we had to pick Russia, which wasn't only more convenient, but again, which justified what we're doing in these countries. You know, Henry Kissinger recently said that we cannot allow ISIS to be destroyed because it would help strengthen Iran. I mean, that is how crazy some of our leaders are. And so we're actually being led to be convinced that the terrorists are our friends.
Yeah. The response of the U.S. media now, including the Washington Post, seems to be not to convey this sort of sanity that you are, but rather to defend poor Morgan Freeman, against whom Russia has launched a war of online criticism, or you know, acts that amount to war. What is Morgan Freeman the victim here?
Of course not. You know, and as you say, they're claiming, oh, Russian trolls are now going after Morgan Freeman. No, a lot of very serious American intellectuals are going after him. People who care about war and peace are going after him, and deservedly so. What he did, what Rob Reiner did, was completely irresponsible. In fact, I keep waiting to see one of them, if not both, apologize, because I can't believe that in the light of the day they feel it's justified to call for war on Russia, which is exactly what they did. No, they're not the victim here. The victim is us, frankly, for them trying to manipulate us in supporting the next war.
Yeah, but have we found it? We've got just a minute left. Okay, has anybody found a famous actor or actress willing to talk sanity and rule of law and responsible behavior with regard to Russia?
I can't think of any off the top of my head. Maybe a Danny Glover, you know. But I don't recall any saying anything. I mean, really, the Russia narrative that's being pushed by the mainstream press seems to be on lockdown. There's very little debate or room for debate. In fact, like the old McCarthy period, if you defend Russia or even claim we shouldn't be have hostilities towards Russia, you are a suspect and yourself a Russian dupe.
Yeah, which is why I'm not going to hold my breath for that apology from Morgan Freeman. Daniel Kovalik is the author of the book The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, How the CIA and the Deep State Have Conspired to Vilify Russia. Dan, thank you very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org.
Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org.
All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time. We'll be right back.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as Puerto Rico suffers extraordinary devastation in the wake of Hurricane Maria and Hurricane Irma, some in the media are asking, is Puerto Rico Trump's Katrina? Besides viewing the staggering humanitarian disaster through the lens of Trump's political fortunes, the question usually turns out to be about Trump's, like George W. Bush's, tone deafness or callousness when it comes to talking about a catastrophe overwhelmingly affecting people of color. A more substantive angle would be to talk about what happened to New Orleans in Katrina's wake, the displacement, the rush to privatization and gentrification, the phenomenon Naomi Klein has labeled disaster capitalism. Pointing out that Trump is behaving boorishly is not the same as digging into those questions or offering an alternative vision for Puerto Rico's recovery. We'll talk about the natural and unnatural crises Puerto Rico is facing with journalist Ed Morales. That's coming up, but first we'll take a very quick look back at recent press. Many in corporate media have been warning about the threat Donald Trump might pose to a free press since before the election. It's strange, then, that, as Adam Johnson reminds, the attack on the press that kicked off the Trump administration, the arrest and subsequent threatening of two journalists with 70 years in prison, has been met with total silence from most of these same outlets. Aaron Cantu, Santa Fe reporter, staff writer, and editor at The New Inquiry, and a contributor to Fair.org, and professional photographer Alexei Wood are both facing decades in prison for the act of covering the January 20th unrest in D.C., charged with felony rioting for little more than being in the proximity of window breaking and brick throwing. Prosecutors initially brought and then dropped felony charges against six other reporters, though it's not clear how their cases differ from Cantu and Wood's. ACLU lawyer Scott Michaelman insists that the arrests punish journalists for being near the action and will inevitably chill freedom of the press and with it First Amendment rights not only of the journalists themselves but of all of us. Nevertheless, the three most influential media reporters in U.S. media, CNN's Brian Stelter, The New York Times' Jim Rutenberg, and Washington Post's Eric Wemple, have completely ignored the felony rioting charges leveled against the two J20 journalists altogether. In their dozens of columns, reports, and on-air segments since the arrests 9 months ago, none of them have devoted a word to the reporters facing jail time. Top journalists warn of threats to press freedom under Trump, warned Stelter right before the election, citing his boss and probably the single person most responsible for Trump, CNN head Jeff Zucker, and his colleague Christiane Amanpour. Stelter sounded the alarm on the authoritarian tendencies of the incoming regime. Jim Rutenberg later offered a 4th of July-themed breakdown of press freedoms under siege by the Trump administration, lamenting Trump's personal attacks against journalists, mean gifts and misuse of the fake news label, as well as Republican politician Greg Gianforte's body slamming of Guardian reporter Ben Jacobs. But somehow, threatening journalists with decades in prison just doesn't register. We've noted before that corporate media in general expressed collective indifference to the unprecedented mass arrests of the J20 protesters, while moral grandstanding at the Russian government for its mass arrest of protesters in June. The Times' Rutenberg found time for not one or two, but four different articles on the corrosive effects on American democracy of the Russian government-run outlet RT, a network that, Johnson notes, reaches less than 30,000 people per show, or roughly 0.3% of the ratings of Judge Judy, Evidently, the Times felt the topic of RT needed more attention. Stories in Fortune, Politico, Time Magazine, The Washington Post, The Guardian, Bloomberg, Foreign Affairs, The Wall Street Journal, The National Review, Christian Science Monitor, and The New York Times itself were presumably insufficient. The fact that there are millions more Americans reading profiles hand-wringing over RT than actually watching it doesn't stop these critics from speaking truth to power in another country. Stelter and Rutenberg did not respond to Fair's request for comment. Wemple told Fair, quote, "There are hundreds of worthy and important stories that I don't get to," close quote. But for journalists covering U.S. media in 2017, the prosecution of Cantu and Wood is not just another story. These are journalists facing decades in prison for doing exactly what journalists are supposed to be doing, covering the opposition to an administration that establishment media reporters have been warning about since 2015. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The New York Times may have meant well with their September 24th editorial headlined, "Puerto Rico is American. We can't ignore it now," which called on all Americans to rally behind their fellow citizens as Puerto Rico faces staggering devastation after Hurricanes Maria and Irma. But there's something hollow about underscoring the Americanness of people who do not, in fact, have the same rights of U.S. citizenship, and in describing the factors that make the disaster much worse and harder to address, namely Puerto Rico's crushing debt and stifled economy, as persistent agonies, as though they were endemic conditions which we can only look upon and lament. With thousands of people lacking water, electricity, fuel, food, and homes, the hurricanes created one sort of crisis in Puerto Rico, but they've brought another into stark relief. What possible ways forward are there that could address both? Ed Morales is a freelance journalist and poet. He teaches at the Center for Ethnicity and Race at Columbia University and is co-director of the documentary film Whose Barrio? About gentrification in East Harlem. He joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Ed Morales.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I hardly know where to start. First, I know that you have family in Puerto Rico. You've been able to be in touch with them?
Yeah, my closest relative is my mom, and she lives up in the mountains near the rainforest. And I haven't been able to speak with her directly, but in a kind of a freak occurrence, an ex-neighbor of hers who had moved to the town below, you know, I've heard that on some of the major highways you can get cell service even if you're not in the metropolitan area. So she called my sister and told her that my mom's okay and there was minimal damage to the house. So I assume it was on a good side of the mountain and was maybe actually protected by one of the sides of the mountain. But that was 5 days ago, and I'm getting more concerned. And actually, I have tickets to go down next Wednesday to make sure she's okay.
Well, let's talk about what's happening now and the U.S. government's response. We understand that Trump has approved a 10-day waiver of the Jones Act, which prohibited ships not made, owned, and crewed by U.S. citizens from delivering goods to the island. So it prevented Puerto Rico's neighbors from bringing aid from day one. Waiving the Jones Act sounds good for the short term, but I can't see how that's sufficient. What do you make of the Trump administration's response so far?
Well, yeah, definitely sluggish. I mean, as is most things that happen with Trump. And, you know, it's hard to tell whether it's negligence or purposeful. But even just incompetence seems to work for the Trump administration. You know, as we've seen, it's almost part of the plan governing by chaos and incompetence. The thing with the Jones Act and the fact that he suspended it temporarily was probably more because he's concerned, you know, with his image in the media, and it was a bad look. But yes, despite the fact that that's now suspended, I mean, the big problem that seems to be prominent now, and it was just reported on CNN and a lot of other places, is there's a lot of containers of supplies that are actually at the port, which weren't prevented by the Jones Act. And for varying reasons, like lack of fuel for the trucks to get them out to the countryside, and also lack of drivers who may be homeless or incommunicado to actually do the driving of the trucks.
Well, a number of media have been kind of riffing on how a lot of Americans don't even know Puerto Rico is part of the U.S., you know, snicker, snicker. But it isn't really that simple. I mean, the Jones Act, which doesn't apply to the U.S. Virgin Islands, for example, is just one of the ways that Puerto Rico exists in a strange relationship to mainland U.S. How is that relationship and Puerto Rico's status impacting the situation now?
I actually have had trouble with myself insisting on a huge program of redevelopment sponsored by the U.S. government and actually feeling like it's necessary for at least some military to show up to help restore infrastructure, because I eventually want the goal of independence and I don't want to rely on the U.S. However, it's such an incredibly catastrophic situation that, you know, supporting this kind of help, you know, is absolutely necessary to save people's lives, and I would prefer to see it as a sort of a down payment for reparations in the future regarding the colonial status of Puerto Rico. But, you know, Puerto Ricans have always had second-class citizenship, as you know. You know, Puerto Ricans on the island can't vote for president, don't have representation in Congress, and I think it's analogous to the second-class citizenship that African Americans and Native Americans have, the internally colonized have in the United States, and I don't think it's a coincidence that Colin Kaepernick's story and this story have a sort of a synergistic relationship. It shows Trump representing the historical white supremacy of the U.S. facing off between internal and externally colonized people who are second-class citizens.
Pretty much every story about the hurricane mentions the debt. Puerto Rico has some $68 million in debt. When you hear debt crisis, it implies people were living high on the hog and spending beyond their means, and now, as Trump would say, sadly, it's time to pay the piper. What should we know about the debt and the measures taken to address it?
The PROMESA Act, passed in a bipartisan way by including some of the more liberal Democratic senators last year, you know, I'm surprised that people last year were not saying that, well, we're American citizens, how can they do this to us? Because they're essentially taking away Puerto Ricans' right to autonomous government on the island. And the same way that Puerto Ricans have a non-voting representative in Congress, it's called the Resident Commissioner. It's now Jennifer Gonzalez from the Statehood Party. On the PROMESA board itself, the governor has a non-voting representative. So even the governor of Puerto Rico just cannot vote in issues that come up before PROMESA, and then PROMESA has to approve all budgetary matters. That in itself was an abysmal situation, but I think that's I don't want to say it's interesting, because it's an incredible human tragedy what's going on in Puerto Rico, but the fact that there's such widespread devastation, I mean, first of all, it puts their budgetary plans in absolute uncertainty. The revenues that were supposed to be generated by even the, you know, failing economy that was happening there, I mean, are just, how can you project them? We're going to have really an exodus of a lot of people. Their businesses are not working. There's a problem with people receiving Social Security and entitlement checks, you know, that's coming up soon because banks are not working. So it's hard to imagine that there's any way that the plans about repaying the debt really can move forward at this point. I mean, there has to be a huge rebuilding of the island before, you know, we can even get back to what PROMESA was thinking about.
I did want to underscore your point about the anti-democratic nature of the financial oversight board that PROMESA put in place. These were economic decisions that are being made over the heads of people without their participation, and yet it's certainly the people who are suffering under them. But going forward, in a Washington Post op-ed, Rutgers professor Yari Marbonilla recounted a conversation she had had with a wealth manager in Puerto Rico who was upbeat about the island's economy. Investments were doing well after Trump's election, and this person said, quote, "The only thing we need now is a hurricane," close quote. It chills the heart to hear that some people see humanitarian disasters as an opportunity for gain, but of course they do. Is that what we possibly are looking at now with Puerto Rico, this disaster capitalism?
Years ago, Naomi Klein, you know, related that to what happened in Louisiana with Katrina, and the remark by that person to Yarimar, indicative of probably experiences of Home Depot actually having profited from other natural disasters.
Yeah, so the idea is that some people will see this as almost, as they did with New Orleans, like, oh, now we have a clean slate.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and we can push through a lot of things, including privatization.
Yeah. The thing with New Orleans is that, and even with all of the recent hurricane disasters in the United States, you have these regions that are affected that, you know, are seriously affected, and there's a considerable area involved, but there are neighboring areas that, you know, can sort of absorb some of the population or send help easily on trucks. And the thing about Puerto Rico is that it's an incredible scale of devastation that resembles what happened with Barbuda under Irma and other smaller islands, where almost the entire island is devastated. So no help, or there's no stability in any region on the island that can help support recovery efforts. For instance, Sandy, you know, knocked out a few places in the southern shores of New York City, but the rest of New York City went on, and then the tri-state area was able to help the victims of Sandy. And it's not the case in Puerto Rico, as it is in some of those smaller Caribbean islands that were also devastated.
Right. Well, I'm also reading, again, talking about the debt, that there's concern that the oversight board may sort of channel funds toward recovery efforts that allow bondholders to be paid back, that will be the priority, or that they will prioritize service to the tourist sector, you know, at the expense of the rest of Puerto Rico. Is it your sense or concern that this debt servicing that seems to be put forward, that will impact the way recovery happens?
Yeah, I hadn't heard that, but I'm not surprised at all, and that would be logical because, you know, they would justify it on the grounds that the tourist sector is one of the last remaining viable industries that could be up and running. In fact, you know, I've heard reports that some of the hotels are functioning somewhat normally, and, you know, you don't have to go into the countryside and you can just sit there on the beach and still go swimming. So that's the problem. You know, there's many problems. These natural disasters reveal the difference in social classes and the way poor people usually are devastated the worst, and that recovery efforts have, you know, continually driven to favor the private sector or money classes.
Well, you might not always see it clearly through media coverage, but there are other possible ways forward. Let's talk about, as you do in your Nation piece, let's talk about if we were to apply, I would say, humanistic principles instead of this ideology of private gain. What could happen if we could exert the will? What could happen going forward in Puerto Rico?
Well, you know, when I first wrote the bit about what Roosevelt did, Franklin Roosevelt, for the Nation. You know, and in fact, there are these main streets in San Juan that are named after Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt as a result of those efforts. Felt like, wow, you know, this is so anachronistic to be writing this. I mean, nobody really believes in this, you know, government providing this massive Keynesian infusion to infrastructure and creating jobs for people without worrying about the private sector. But, you know, I kind of wanted to leave it in because I wanted to maybe point out how maybe even a lot of our leaders, maybe on the moderate left or the Democratic end of the spectrum, are not even suggesting things like this and would probably feel powerless bringing stuff like this up in Congress when it's exactly what is needed. We have a problem in this country about how we've devalued that era of American history. It's really funny how some of these Make America Great Again people, you know, what was the greatest era, at least in the 20th century in American history, was the era of fighting, recovering from the Depression and fighting in the Great War that had the moral cause, World War II. And what was happening during that era? There was high taxation of wealthy people, and there were huge government investment programs, and that's what created the middle class. But, you know, there are so many people who don't remember those things, and that is what's needed, and I put it out there, and I hope someone takes it seriously, but frankly, I felt like I was, you know, on the fringe saying something like that.
Well, I actually have seen a few little glimpses here and there, even in the press, columnist Jeff Spross at The Week had a column in which he said, you know, just spend the money necessary to repair Puerto Rico society. And he talked about the government just paying off the debt. You know, $70 billion, he points out, would increase federal spending by 1.8% for 1 year.
Mm-hmm. And that's what should have happened instead of PROMESA. But you didn't see any strong Democratic party besides Bernie Sanders supporting that idea.
Yeah, and Yarimar Bonilla says in that Washington Post piece that part of the reason that PROMESA was such a non-solution and so short-sighted was fear in Washington that the legislation would be viewed as a federal bailout.
Right, yeah, that's it. And, you know, then you even had Puerto Ricans saying, we don't want a bailout, you know, as if there was something morally wrong with it.
Right. The disconnect also in terms of just money and what it actually means, and I do fault media to some extent for not making these things clear, because you know that people would say, oh, we can't afford this investment in Puerto Rico. We can't afford it, you know. And these will be, many of them, the same people who had nothing to say when the Senate voted to increase military spending by $81 billion to $700 billion. Just the increase is more than the entirety of Puerto Rico's debt.
Yeah.
So it's not really about money. Well, let me ask you, what's the role for the media here? How can it help? How can it hinder? What would you like to see in terms of, we know they're going to be covering it, but what would you like to see that coverage do?
Well, I would like to see an avoidance of gratuitous, I don't think it's happened yet, but I think that during the Virgin Islands disasters, there was some gratuitous reporting about looting, you know, which juxtaposed white tourists, you know, with people of color looting stores in the town. I think that, you know, that this could be a problem, because one of the problems with the military aid that's coming is that some of that personnel may be used to enforce something like martial law, and there could be sensationalist use of, I mean, you know, we don't even know if we want to call it looting if it's out of necessity, but of those kind of activities be blown out of proportion to rationalize a continued military presence. And the other thing is that it's really important to just, you know, really use it as a way to not only study what's happened now, but really find out about Puerto Rico, you know, because there's been very little attempt by the media to really find out what Puerto Rico is about, how it's a really interesting juxtaposition between a vital cosmopolitan urban center and some amazing rustic folkloric communities that keep the notion of the culture alive and actually engage in subsistence farming in some cases, and all under, you know, supposedly under the U.S. flags. And again, like I think that the media really needs to report that, as I mentioned before, the magnitude of the crisis is because almost the entire island is affected. And I think most of the time when people see reports, they all that, well, surely this is just some areas that are deeply affected and others are not. But I think that should be done to really emphasize the magnitude of the problem.
Well, and then, so, I mean, we have seen media being critical of Trump and his tweets and his tweet about the debt in this context, but it was kind of as though this isn't the moment to mention that, you know, as though it's just sort of unseemly. But there's going to be reporting on the debt as well. And you do talk about what might happen with what should happen or could happen with that debt in the Nation piece. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem is that it's kind of bigger than Trump and his narrow-minded politics or even just the greed of our system. One of the Achilles heels of the global capitalist system now is that the financial sector has been overused in terms of generating profit, and so the municipal bond market is almost as important as, you know, the oil economy for the world in terms of generating profits. And so the government doesn't, quote unquote, bail out Puerto Rico. There's going to be a serious destabilization of the bond market, and that might alarm the Trump's Wall Street friends. So, I mean, I think that it's a little bit beyond just, you know, how we perceive Trump as sort of racist and neglectful. This really has the potential of creating a situation like we had in 2008, a real destabilizing situation in the world economy. That's why these battles were fought so hard in Argentina and Greece. But Argentina and Greece did not undergo this unbelievable cataclysmic atmospheric event that virtually decimated any kind of productive activity the way it is now in Puerto Rico.
It's hard to think of looking at the situation and thinking what it calls for is more austerity. And yet that seems to be the kind of sort of automatic response.
Yeah, but it's kind of untenable. I mean, you know, it's going to be fascinating to watch. It's like imposing austerity on someone who is on their deathbed.
Well, and as you say, interesting, and I'll let you go, but I think it is interesting in the sense that it seems to be kind of a which side are you on? I mean, it does seem like a moment where we have a choice to make about how we're going to go forward and how we're a big picture choice of how we're going to respond to events like this, because we certainly know with climate disruption, this is not the last time. This is not the last we're going to see of it. And so we're going to be confronting these same questions again and again, and we have an opportunity to maybe do something different.
Yeah, that's how I try to wind up my nation piece, which was talking about Puerto Rico being a mirror of America's potential dystopic future, and hoping that in the mainland people realize that it may not be now, it may be 10 or 20 or 30 or 40, 50 years, but this could be their future. You know, these policies of government neglect, of private sector only, and increasing climate disasters are going to create Hurricane Maria's in pockets of the first world, and some people are going to be left behind. What happened in Sandy? People with the fewest resources had to pack up and leave, and the same with Katrina. People became refugees, and that's another big problem that's going on in Puerto Rico now is people who have been forced from their homes. Where are those people going to go?
We've been speaking with writer Ed Morales. His article, Puerto Rico Needs Massive Emergency Aid Now and an End to Austerity, appears in the most recent issue of The Nation. You can also find his work online at edmorales.net. Ed Morales, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me. I hope we have better news soon.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR.org. That's also the place to sign up for our email network. The show is engineered by Erica Rosado. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. In our second half hour, I'll be talking with author, blogger, John Michael Greer. He thinks we can walk back technology to safer options that can live past the crash. But first, we explore the wonders of how the climate really works, why the ozone hole and climate change work at cross purposes, Antarctica and fires in the Southern Hemisphere. It's science the way I like it, with Dr. Andres Holtz.
Radio EcoShock.
Wildfires are big news in North America, Europe, and Siberia. But what about in the Southern Hemisphere? In January 2017, during the Southern summer, Chile experienced the largest wildfire in its history. A new study recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences says wildfires in Southern South America have increased, and they will become more prevalent as global warming advances. But it's a complicated picture influenced by human behavior, the ozone hole, changing winds from Antarctica, and something called teleconnection. To sort it out, we've reached the lead author, Andres Holtz, from Portland State University. Holtz has a PhD in geography from the University of Colorado, but also a degree in forestry engineering from the Universidad de Chile in Santiago. His specialties include wildfires in southern South America, as well as in Tasmania and New Zealand. Andres, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You study wildfires, and as we speak, you are in a heavy smoke event in Portland, and it's pretty bad around here, too. What is happening in the Portland area?
Oh, we have basically a bit of the perfect storm combinations of factors between a very dry and warm summer that has dried all the fuels, and then apparently ignition, still to figure out exactly the details, but an ignition in a forest that is ready to burn. And here we go. I can barely see the silhouette of the mountains as we speak.
You know, as I look at the world fire scene, my question sounds simple. Have there been more forest fires in southern South America, and is it due to climate change? But reading your paper, it's a very complex mix of factors. First of all, how did you define southern South America?
That's a great question for a geographer. That's a constructed concept, much like Patagonia or the Pacific Northwest. If you ask 20 people in a room, everybody with a pen and a map, they're going to draw a slightly different region. And so it's a mentally constructed place. We generally speak about the Southern Cone or Southern South America, which includes Argentina, perhaps even bits of Uruguay and Southern Brazil and Chile.
To understand your work, we need to grasp a climate pattern called the Southern Annular Mode, or SAM. It's also known as the Antarctic Oscillation. Please describe that for us.
Sure thing. As you well pointed out, SAM, or the Antarctic Oscillation, it's basically much like a ring of various pressures, of usually high or low pressures, and this ring expands and contracts around Antarctica. There's also a northern annular mode, or the Arctic Oscillation, that is less known and less famous in the northern hemisphere because it's not as prevalent, because it's not as strong, and that's due to basically the fact that the northern hemisphere is a landmass continent, whereas the southern hemisphere is an ocean-dominated continent. And at the southern pole, you have this massive Antarctic continent surrounded by water. And so the actual ring is almost perfect, that when it expands, creates some or drags some particular weather pattern in the mid to high latitude in the southern hemisphere, and similarly in the Antarctic continent as well. And so listeners might be familiar with El Niño or La Niña, which is basically a combination of temperatures in the ocean that drives pressures in the atmosphere that then in turn drives weather patterns. This is more or less the same, with the difference, and the big difference, that it's mostly and primarily an atmospheric pressure-driven oscillation. It has no ocean temperature component.
So what do pressure systems of Antarctica have to do with forest fires in South Chile and Argentina?
That's a great question. Basically, when this ring expands, and imagine that the boundary of the ring has high pressure centers, what it basically does, much like in the Pacific Northwest, where the westerlies are the one coming from the ocean that bring all the precipitation to these coastal areas, this ring, when actually expands with high pressure, blocks these westerlies. And so the westerlies that are carrying the precipitation go towards the poles, in this case, towards the south. And so we have extended and unusually long fire seasons or drought seasons because of that effect of the ring. Then in combination with more ignitions, primarily due to people, humans, living in the area, colonizing the area, traveling in the area, and also an increase in lightning that has been clearly driven by warmer waters, we have, again, this perfect storm of perfect combinations where we see more and more fires.
Now, I have heard of this described to me as a tightening of the winds around Antarctica by another scientist, and he said that affected the rainfall and fires in Australia's Tasmania and in New Zealand. Are we talking about the same thing?
We're talking about the same thing. So my work in Tasmania and New Zealand, it's trying to also understand the relative importance of SAM with ENSO and also with the Indian Ocean Dipole, which is another oscillation that different parts of the Southern Hemisphere are exposed to or basically are influenced by. There's still work to do to understand how these actually interact and feed each other or even buff each other. But yes, it definitely affects very similarly precipitation patterns, temperature patterns, and fire patterns in both New Zealand and southeastern Australia, including Tasmania.
Now, I was surprised to learn from your paper that a major cause of this tightening around Antarctica was not global warming, but the ozone hole. How did that work?
Yeah, the ozone hole, it's an interesting one. And initially, this southern annular mode pattern deviation, if I can call it that way, meaning that instead of going positive, which is the expansion and created this sort of ridge that blocks the westerlies and creates drought and fire, then it switches into negative, which creates actually high rainfall in southern South America and then so on and so forth. It turns out initially that the ozone hole was the first driver identified to influence SAM. A couple of years later, it turns out that also global warming affects the SAM. And it turns out actually that each of them affect them in opposite directions. The ozone hole pushes the rain towards the equator, and the global warming pushes the boundary of the rain towards the pole. And in short, the ozone hole way of impacting the SAM is, if we think about what the ozone does, it's basically, it's a layer that is in the stratosphere that basically converts the quality of the insulation into a quality that is less harmful for life on Earth. When it does so, actually, the stratospheres in above warms up. And so if you reduce the amount of ozone, the amount of conversion of this energy is less, and hence the stratosphere, particularly in Antarctica, has been cooling. And this cooling has been the one affecting now the troposphere underneath. And so the ozone hole is, through a vertical dynamics, is affecting the actual temperature conditions in Antarctica in the troposphere. That in turn now actually enhances the way that the vortex works out. And if you think of Antarctica being this massive continent, the center of Antarctica, or the largest half, which is called East Antarctica, has been cooling and cooling. And it's one of the regions around the globe, actually, that's been cooling, which in turn now West Antarctica, which is smaller, has been warming very rapidly. And so this cooling now, it's basically almost like a hole that has very high pressure, very cold. And so it pulls the vortex towards it and makes it more and more faster with wetter and wetter conditions in actually mid and high latitudes in southern South America.
And one of the strange aspects, though, is that these changes, Antarctica is still quite far away from most of South America across an ocean. So please tell us about teleconnection. What is that and how does that affect what we're talking about, the wildfires?
Teleconnections is the idea there is a connection between two phenomena, in this case, meteorological or synoptic scale climate phenomena, that are geographically remotely. And so we can run, for instance, correlations between one phenomena and another and have no clue how they're connected, but they seem to be correlated. It took for us ecologists to wait that the climatologists and atmospheric scientists could figure out what the mechanisms were, if there were any, of course, so that we can actually understand and then use it or apply to try to understand what those impacts were. And in short, it's basically propagations of heat waves between tropical latitudes in the case of warming that go polarward, or the opposite, basically high polar latitudes pulling these high or low riches or rings of this boundary of the SAM that then in turn affects remotely precipitations all the way up to even northern Chile. There have been studies that have linked and this sort of cascade effect of chain effect all the way to the highlands and the mass of glaciers in the Altiplano at 17 or 20 degrees latitudes, how quick the actual glaciers are melting.
I find that amazing. I mean, we're talking about almost swirls of air, if you will, another kind of ocean that we humans are not really equipped to understand. You know, we don't run into this every day. So we're just finding out about teleconnection. I mean, one of the early scientific theories about how it worked turned out to be false. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah, well, my understanding of it, and I'm not a climate scientist, is that climate teleconnections really became popular when we understood better the 1982-83 El Niño event. It was the first time that we had satellite data that tracked not only the changes in the geography of the warm and cold waters in the Pacific Basin, but also the effects of those and the effects of those at tropical latitudes, but then also how those were pushing low and high pressure centers to different latitudes, to different longitudes, and how that in turn were actually affecting areas that were quite remote from the actual tropical latitudes. For instance, South Africa is affected by El Niño. It's far away. Same with India and things that are quite remote. But if you follow much like a train, they are connected one wagon to the next one into this sort of chain of events, of phenomena.
Now, humans have restricted the use of ozone-damaging chemicals. If the ozone hole begins to shrink, as we hope, does that mean that wildfires in the southern part of South America could begin to decline?
That's a great question. We were very hopeful of that. First, quick caveat is the ozone hole is recovering in a more erratic pattern that we or most scientists expected. And so we see that it's recovering, but then has something like hiccups and then expands again. And so most projections from a decade ago or so would have put a current ozone hole much smaller than we see today. That's one. And then the second is that now we have global warming affected the SAM as well. And so the SAM, it's, as I pointed out before, so global warming is pushing the SAM in the opposite direction. And so even though the ozone hole fully recovers, the SAM is going to remain in its positive fire-prone state. And so unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be the case, that fires are going to be or are going to start declining in the future because of SAM, and let alone because of things like El Niño and even secular trends of warming that are more like steady warming up and up.
Well, let's get to your specialty in the forests themselves. What kind of forests are considered in your study?
This was a meta-analysis. It's a large synthesis of 17 plus 100 fire scarred trees across from subantarctic latitudes at 54 degrees or so, all the way to 22 in subtropical latitudes in northern Argentina, right at the boundary with Bolivia. And so it encompasses from tiny trees and what it would be almost boreal forest in the northern hemisphere, what we call subantarctic forest, which is a tiny, tiny biome or even ecosystem. Then moving farther north with more taller rainforests, cool forests, and warm rainforests. Then an overlap or a transition zone between temperate and Mediterranean type of forests, which would be basically like Western Oregon right here in terms of the analogy for the northern hemisphere. And then moving into more savanna-like type of forests in central Chile and also in northwestern Argentina.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Dr. Andres Holtz about new science on why wildfires are increasing in the southern part of South America. So you study trees that were damaged by fires. How far back does that record take you, and what was the general period used for your paper?
The oldest fire scar that we found was in 990 AD, so basically 1,100 years old fire scar. And this was from a Fitzroy cupressoides, also termed the redwood of the southern hemisphere. So very wet rainforest that burns very infrequently and that had fire scars.
But you used from the 1600 ons for most of the basis of your paper, is that right?
That's right. Mostly because we wanted to see what most of the trees were telling us. We started the analysis during a period where our sample size was high, was strong enough.
All right. Now, you say the activities of humans are a further complication. We have colonists burning away forest for agriculture, later the whole technology of fighting forest fires. How did you account for that in your study?
Fortunately for this type of analysis, and unfortunately for the forests themselves, fire suppression in general, it's been a very incipient technological advance in southern South America. And so perhaps only in central Chile, starting in the 50s or so, and then also in some of the Araucaria monkey puzzle tree forest in the 40s in northwestern Patagonia, it's really the first time where we see a very small effort to stop fires. And because of that, that's exactly the time where we actually truncated the analysis.
And we know that wildfire activity is harmful to human health. In fact, I haven't been able to go outside as much as usual this summer due to multiple large fires in British Columbia and in Washington State. But you also suggest the release of carbon from increasing fires could become, quote, a strong feedback to the climate system. Please talk to us about that.
So carbon coming from fires in some particular years can be a significant contribution for the global carbon emission of a given year. And if this becomes more and more recurrent and becomes a norm, we know that higher concentrations of carbon in the atmosphere, like any other greenhouse gas, both delays the amount of heat that actually, or traps more heat, so increases the amount of heat that gets trapped in the atmosphere, and at the same time delays furthermore the release of heat into the outer space. So our greenhouse, we call it greenhouse because it's not a perfect greenhouse that fully keeps the heat, but definitely delays the actual rate of heat dissipation into outer space. And so it makes sense to think that if we have more CO2 coming out of fires, we're going to see more warming. And then in turn, those forests whose fires depend on higher temperatures are expected to see more and more fires along with longer fire seasons.
I talked to a Canadian fire expert who said that, sure, we expect some of that carbon to be recaptured as forests regrow, but if they get extreme fires in a short period of time, then the forests don't regrow and it converts into grasslands or some other type of vegetation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. Some of the ongoing projects and also pending proposals, we hope they turn into projects in the future, are exactly trying to look at that. Trying to understand what the short and mid-term impacts of particularly fires that burn on previous burns, what we call reburns, and what the ecological effect of that is. And our hunch is that to some extent, this might be a little lens into the future, maybe 50, 100 years from now, where vegetations dry out naturally or not naturally, but directly from climate, not through burning. And that actually basically favors plants and taxa in general that is more drought adapted. Whereas when fires burn in a wet forest or a mesic forest and then burns it again and becomes a shrubland or even a grassland, well, this might be actually a sort of a travel or a journey to the future to see how this forest might be in 100 years from now. And so understanding what are the main players of those novel ecosystems today can help us to perhaps develop policy around that or even agree on what we would like to see in the landscapes.
Once you assembled your record, Andres, of fires over several centuries, can we say for certain that wildfire activity has increased since the 1900s, say, in southern South America?
We definitely see, I think, both. We see variability in general, up and down. And in some areas, we can say, yes, we see an increase in fire activity. It's hard to see or to say that these increases are only due to global warming. Because as I pointed out before, we need ignitions. And as most coastal rainforests on western sides of continents around the globe, ignitions are rare. And so we have yet to see a pervasive increase of lightning strikes everywhere in the southern, in the wet forests in South America. That said, we definitely see an increase in lightning activity, statistically significant, particularly steadily in the mid-1970s when ENSO and the Pacific Decadal Oscillation both flipped at their sign in 1976-1977, and that created massive changes in the temperature of the water, the amount of pressure cells, the convectivity, which in turn drives ignition patterns, and so on and so forth, in terms of lightning. And so I guess the answer is depends, and in some places, yes, in some places, no. And to wrap up, then, we also analyzed the synchrony of fire activity, and that tends to be increasing in its amplitude, both in higher synchrony and in lower synchrony in very recent times. So it seems that in the past, it was less synchrony and less asynchronous, whereas more recently, we see a much more, I don't know, extreme pattern of very synchronous and very asynchronous.
What do you mean by synchrony in fires?
It's basically a simple idea that sites that are remotely locating are experiencing fires at the same time during the same fire season.
Now, who is watching and measuring these wildfires? Is it governments? Are there other institutions? Who's doing it?
Nowadays, fires are definitely being more and more considered, and I'm speaking now from a Chilean's perspective, into the national policy, into the national agenda. When I started working for my PhD, for instance, which was the first work I led in fire ecology and fire climate dynamics, I was told that fires were rare. Fires were only caused by the settlers that moved to Patagonia 60, 80 years ago, and the indigenous didn't burn, and so on and so forth. We had no linings, and turns out that I found lots of fire scars that were pre-settlers, so the indigenous had to be lining, had to be igniting. I also found fire scars that I could tell were from lining, so there were also those. And so I feel that, and then as you well pointed out, last year or this past summer season, there were massive fires in central Chile. There were in last year and 2015, there were big fires in these thousand-year-old forests, Araucaria forests, and even some bits of Fitzroya, both the monkey puzzle tree and the redwood in southern Chile and northwestern Patagonia in Argentina, that were burned. And people were very pissed off and very angry and very sad about this. And the government definitely struggled in terms of how to deal with this. They did the best that they could. But at the same time, now it's the idea to gather and think about policies for restoration, what restoration should look like, and so on and so forth.
What can our listeners in Australia and New Zealand learn from your newly published paper?
Well, New Zealand, it's a fascinating place to study fires, and collaborators there have been doing this for several decades. New Zealand is an area that is uber maritime, and so it's very hard for New Zealand to get any lightning whatsoever because it's so thin, and it's obviously extremely wet on the west side and less so in the east side. And New Zealand also, it's a natural, beautiful experiment because, a laboratory, because it had no humans until 800 years ago. And so we can look at the non-human fire dynamics, fire climate dynamics, which, again, being so maritime-driven, it was very, very slim and very, very few fires, and how then Maori people, Polynesians, change the vegetation through fire in just a few decades, even maybe a century or so. And even though it's been estimated that there were very few people. And so New Zealanders, I would say that they generally have perceive fires as something totally foreign, totally alien. And in the last 10 years, I feel that that is also starting to change. And I think it was this past summer that New Zealand also saw some major fires outside of I don't remember the city that it was, but it was, people were definitely concerned. In fact, I was at a meeting in May, I believe. Yeah, it was in May, where I sat down with a couple of New Zealand ecologists, and they were like, yeah, we were concerned. And so it's definitely something that's going to change. And one of the best papers and analysis on the impact, for instance, going back to the farm, on drought and fire risk has been shown for New Zealand. And so even though it's so maritime, the only thing that it needs is an ignition at the end of the summer, and that forest or many of those forests can burn again.
I know. I talked to a fire expert in Tasmania, and they had a shocking fire season, as we all know. It was well reported in the world news. But even a forest in the northern part of Tasmania that hadn't burned for many, many centuries caught fire. It was a national park, I believe it was. It was very frightening for the people there.
Yeah, I have a hunch who you talk to, who is probably my collaborator in Tasmania, that I worked there as a postdoc fellow. And we were exactly working there in the central northern area where this thousand-year-old forest, or I don't know, many hundreds of year-old trees in this subalpine, almost tree-lined plateau, central plateau, it's called. It was very, very severely burned 3 years ago or so.
Yes.
2 years ago. And it was very scary. We are actually currently working on a landscape scale analysis of the fire refuges in Tasmania to try to see whether some of these very millennial scale longleaf conifers, very iconic species, have any chance, or what their potential conditions will be in the future when we unfortunately think that they're going to see more and more fires.
Well, as we wrap up here, Andres, what further research needs to be done now when it comes to southern South America?
At this point, I feel that we have understood fairly well how climatic conditions are driving fires, but we have a lot to learn about how now ecosystems are responding to this apparent surge of wildfire. And so understanding how, for instance, invasive species affect the recovery of native forests, how natives, but also exotic mammals, for instance, are affecting the density of seeds that could potentially be coming to a forest, or if they are being browsed or predated, maybe they're going to be coming to that shrubland, grassland that we discussed before with many invasives. What is going to be the impact of climate change on their recovery? Those are really open questions that we know very little, if anything.
Well, we've never been through a climate change as extreme as it appears we're heading into now, so it's difficult to tell. We have been speaking with Dr. Andres Holtz from Portland State University. He's the lead author of the new paper titled Southern Annular Mode Drives Multicentury Wildfire Activity in Southern South America, that was published at the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS, in August 2017. You can find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Andres, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure for me as well.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Until the Industrial Revolution and the age of fossil power, humans did live sustainably because there was no other choice. Now this civilization seems headed off a series of cliffs, whether it's climate change, wiping out nature, or nuclear demise. Is there another choice, really? Maybe, says author John Michael Greer, we should steer toward the past. Greer is the author of at least 30 books. He deals with alternative lifestyles, ways of thinking, science fiction, a lot of things. His former blog, The Archdruid Report, has a huge following with a lively discussion area. Greer credits his online community as part inspiration for his new book, The Retro Future, Looking into the Past to Reinvent the Future. John Michael Greer, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on again.
Okay, so we can't even think of thoughts we need to discuss without first clearing a few mental landmines that block the way. And the first is often talked about, but few people get past it. Talk to us about the illusion, once again, of never-ending progress.
Oh, yeah. The thing is, you have to understand that progress is the established religion of the modern times. People believe in progress the way medieval peasants believed in the wonder-working bones of St. Ethelfrith. You know, progress is supposed to be omniscient, omnipotent, omnibenevolent. Of course, it's nothing of the kind. But so many people have so much of the hope stuck in this notion that there's this automatic slant to history that means that, well, maybe our lives suck, but in our grandchildren's or our great-grandchildren's time, they will live under they'll live in the perfect progressive utopia. It's nonsense, but like so many kinds of nonsense, people are very deeply emotionally attached to it. And so getting past that religious faith in progress, getting to the point where we realize that progress just means going further in the same direction you're already going, and that progress actually suffers from the same law of diminishing returns as everything else. The first breakthroughs are marvelous. The second breakthroughs are cool. The third ones are pretty good. The fourth, you know, by the time you're getting, you know, 200, 300, 400 years down the road, they're starting to lurch and it's starting to get pretty ugly. There is no rule that we have to keep on going in the same direction. There is no law of nature that requires us to keep on accepting worse and worse products, worse and worse lifestyles, worse and worse everything, just because, you know, some bozo at an ad agency labels it the latest heroic step in progress in man's march from the caves to the stars. It's religion.
But hang on, I'm pretty sure that an app will appear on my iPhone that will solve the energy problem.
I admire your faith. And in fact, that's just it. There have been a few things in recent years where there has been actual technological progress, and computer technology, and generally that the whole range of information technology has actually had some significant gains over the last few decades. Look at all the things that haven't. Your car is basically a piece of 1880s technology gussied up with a few microchips. Okay? Airplanes have not advanced significantly since the end of the Second World War. Most of the technology that actually fills our lives today, our grandparents used the same technologies or you know, were around when they arrived. And so it becomes this desperate clinging to faith in a faltering belief system, very much like the communism that I mocked there earlier. You know, people in the communist countries back in the day all, you know, were taught to believe that, you know, our grandchildren will live under communism, you know, the withering away of the state, the coming of the workers' utopia. And all the time, things actually got worse and worse and worse. We're in exactly the same situation now.
I worry the second illusion that you deal with in your second chapter is also, in a way, related to a problem with your book, though, and that is that humans can decide what's going to happen with our future. Can we really?
Well, to a certain extent, we can decide what will happen with our own personal futures, okay? You can actually choose the main point that I made in that chapter is that you actually have a choice as to which technologies to use. You don't have to use whatever some ad agency wants to shove on you, what some marketer wants you to use. We have a range of choice. That doesn't mean we have absolute choice. Among other things, the Star Trek future, I don't care how much you want that, you're not going to get it. It's become painfully clear over the last 30, 40 years. That whole thing, the whole expansion across the galaxy, blah, 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 it's a pipe dream. And whatever they're putting in the pipes, you can have that if you want. But at any rate, we have some flexibility. We have some freedom. We can make choices. We can say, sure, I'll buy into the latest cheap, shoddy, ecologically devastating, loaded with nasty side effects technology, whatever it is. Or I could say, no, you know, I think I'm going to keep what I have, or worse still, you know, the thing that I was using 10 years ago actually did a better job for less cost and had fewer side effects and problems. I think I'm going to go back to that.
Well, just like you, I'm tired of the green prophets who promise we can use renewable energy like solar or wind and never have to give up anything in our current lifestyles. We'll drive around in electric cars and feel good about it, or maybe everything will be powered by biofuels. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah. That's been going on since I was in high school. Biofuels, yes, we're going to use ethanol. Well, no, that doesn't work. Algal bio. Well, no, that doesn't work. Let's try the next. they've gone through a whole cascade of things. The problem is the Earth doesn't absorb enough concentrated energy from the sun, lots of diffuse energy, okay? Sunlight is not that hot. And so it doesn't. We don't have enough concentrated energy to run our kind of extremely hyper, super, duper energy intensive, wasteful society. We can have a perfectly sensible, perfectly comfortable, perfectly viable, perfectly humane society on a lot less energy than we have now, but we're going to have to get rid of a whole range of energy wasting habits.
Yeah, I'm going for bicycles myself. I think that's the way to go. I've got a cargo bike, and that means I can pick up my groceries, I can carry around a kid or anything I want with it. Don't need the car.
Exactly. A bicycle is a really good way. The technology that I tend to use to get around is called shoe leather. And that's, you know, it works for me very well. The neighborhood where I live right now is it's convenient. I can get to places and so on. Of course, getting to places may involve walking a mile, but hey, that's my healthcare plan, okay?
Yeah. You know, your new book, it's just loaded with powerful phrases like this one. A great many people these days seem to have lost the ability to grasp that the other side can learn. And you were talking first about foreign policy, and I kind of jumped ahead of you and thought, well, yeah, but what about parasites and bacteria and all that? Yeah. What if an intelligent nature decides we're just an interesting experiment, but we're too dangerous to allow to continue?
Or, you know, whether nature chooses that, whether, you know, some virus or bacteria just says, ooh, look at the dinner menu. The thing is, we have this fantasy, and this is like the religion of progress. It's like this fantasy of perpetual progress, okay? The notion that human beings are the only things that can actually change anything. If anything happens in the world, it must be some human being that's doing it. Nature can't do anything by itself. Nothing else can do anything by itself. We are history's actors. That was Karl Rove's delusional line back a few presidencies. And, of course, we know how well that worked for him. The fact is, when we start dumping pesticides on our fields, we just set up the situation so that any plant that can evolve around those pesticides has its open season. You know, any weed, any bug, any plant fungus, you know, it's field day for evolution in this situation. We've lost track of the fact that if we act, other things can react, and they may not react the way we want them to. Half of what's going wrong in our society today is precisely this stupid notion that we can just do whatever we want and nothing will happen. Nature will just sit there. Sorry.
I'm afraid that you've poked away at one of my sacred cows. You say that science may change away from institutional academia, but I have to say that many of the brilliant scientists I've interviewed on Radio EcoShock come from that institutional or modeling environment. I don't think that's done yet.
Well, it may not be done in the sense of there are still things that institutional science can discover. The problem is institutional science going to retain the funding? Is it going to retain the social prestige? Is it going to retain the institutional support that enables it to do those kind of things now? At this point, when, you know, every week some scientist comes on and says, you remember all that stuff that we told you last week about cholesterol or whatever it is? Well, it was all wrong.
That happens over and over again.
It happens. And every time that happens, the people outside the scientific community are looking up with their beady eyes and saying, okay, so why should we believe you this time? And the thing is, they're right to ask that question. Because so much of science these days is corrupt. So much of it is bought and paid for by corporate interests. So much of it is bought and paid for by political interests. What was once one of the grandest achievements of the human mind has become just another marketing department for various commercial interests and political ideologies. And people know that. People are aware of it. And that's why when some bozo in a white lab coat gets up in front of you and says, okay, everything you knew was wrong, here's what you should believe, a growing number of people just look at that and say, okay, why should we trust you? Give me a reason. And the guys in the white lab coats do not handle that well.
So, John Michael Greer, is it true you don't have a television, and how can you live like that?
Well, it is in fact quite true that I don't have a television. I have not had a television in my adult life. And as for how I can live with that, well, you know, here's a secret. Before the 1950s, everybody on the planet lived without a television. You know, they actually seem to have gotten along just fine. Not only that, they got a lot more done than most people get nowadays when they spend 4 to 6 hours a day, you know, with drool puddling on their laps as they sit there watching the Idiot Box. I constantly get people asking me, how do you find the time to write all these books and do this and do that and do the other things? And my answer is very simple. I don't have a television. I have a life instead.
What a concept. I'm sort of worrying that some of the retro movements may be drawing on that same demon of nostalgia that powered Donald Trump into the presidency, saying, go backwards in time and make America great again. Maybe nostalgia is one of the drugs that is poisoning our brains. How would you avoid that?
Well, the first thing, we could get and have a long talk about a lot of what drove the whole Donald Trump phenomenon. Many of our listeners may know, I actually predicted his election in January of 2016, most of a year before it happened. And it's not just nostalgia. There were a lot of failures on the part of the existing political system that basically opened the door to what's happened. But the thing is, nostalgia for the sake of nostalgia is a bad idea. What we need is the idea that we can look at the past and the present, all the available options, and say, okay, which one of these actually serves our purpose? So it's not a matter of wholesalely embracing any particular part of the past, much less a sort of imaginary past of the kind that so many people put their minds to these days. It's a matter of just taking the past as a smorgasbord, taking the past and the present, and say, okay, I want one of these, I want two of those, I take a scoop of this, and mixing them together and see what works. You're not supposed to do that, by the way. That's a total taboo in today's society. You're supposed to just take whatever the nice man on the television wants you to buy. That's not a sane option these days. That's not a survivable option these days. So, come check out the smorgasbord. Come pick up some things and try this and try that and see what works for you personally instead of what works for some Wall Street executive who's trying to shove this stuff down your throat.
I'm aware of several attempts in history to go back to a golden age. The Chaldeans tried to go back to the script and social system of Babylonia. And then all through European history, there have been a series of reclamations of the new Roman Empire. But it was really always something new.
Mm-hmm. And exactly. And in fact, if we do a retro future, if in fact people, realizing that a lot of what we have, what the latest offerings of products are junk, go back to older technologies and older things, it's not going to be going back to some kind of past situation. They're going to do something new with it. An example that I really like these days, typewriters are coming back in. They're being used by artists and poets as performance piece instruments. And there are all kinds of new things being done, things that nobody would ever thought to do with a typewriter back in the day when everyone typed with one. So you see, going back as a way, it becomes a springboard to go forward in a different direction. Remember, progress just means going forward the same way you're going. If you're going off a cliff, that's not a good idea. Go 90 degrees to one side. Go any place. The world is much more three-dimensional. It's not just this straight line going, again, the way some corporate jerk wants you to go.
What do you think of the many predictions that artificial intelligence will replace most of the current workforce, creating a new class of poverty?
They've been saying that since before I was born. It was always going to happen 10 years from now. Seriously, in 1960, they were saying by 1970, 85% of all jobs in America will be replaced by robots. The secret, of course, is that as our economy winds down, as the vast, attempting to prop up an economy that was once propped up by cheap fossil fuels on an endless supply of debt, as that breaks down, a lot of jobs are going away. It's not a matter of people being replaced by robots. It's a matter of an economy coming unglued and people having to step down toward other ways of making a living that don't necessarily feed the pockets of the rich. It's very, very convenient for people who don't want to look at the end of progress to say, oh, no, all this unemployment, it's because of robots, it's because of AI. We have to focus on this idea of progress ever into the future. It's falling dead at our feet. Right now, the great god progress, remember Nietzsche said God is dead. We need a new Nietzsche to say progress is dead. Okay? No, there's no heartbeat. There's no pulse. It's lying there, twitching in front of us. Let's do something else.
I'm Alex Smith with my guest, author and historian of ideas, John Michael Greer. This is Radio EcoShock. You've covered in a previous work another way out, which is collapse now and avoid the rush. Which book do you recommend for that?
That one would probably be The Ecotechnic Future.
Okay. And let's say we need to go back to a time when technology was sustainable, as you suggest. How far back might that be?
It's almost impossible to say because we're not going back to a single time. Again, the smorgasbord approach is what we have to have in mind. We can pick one thing here and one thing there, something from 1950 and something from 1920 and something from 1850 and something from the Bronze Age, if that works. It's not a matter of going back to a specific time because history is not a straight line. It's a smorgasbord. You can pick what you want, assemble it. There's something that people used to talk about, bricolage, the habit of just picking and choosing and putting stuff together like a mosaic. We need a technological bricolage right now. We need to take that approach toward our technology rather than just thinking that, you know, that just because you use a steam engine, you have to wear a Victorian top hat.
In the early 1980s, my wife and I spent 10 years living without electricity. We didn't have a phone or any services. It was a great time, but it helped us to be young and strong, and I'm not sure that works for seniors or people with health problems. What is your advice for people thinking of unplugging?
The thing to do is look at what you actually need and distinguish that from what you've simply gotten used to. And also, you don't have to do it whole hog. Again, smorgasbord. Pick and choose. Decide, okay, you know, I think I need to have this technology so I can get in touch with my doctor, or so I can do this or that or the other. But these other technologies, I don't need them. And in fact, I don't want them. They bore me. So I'm not going to do them. And if people say, well, you have to have that, you can tell them to get stuffed. You don't have to do it whole hog. You don't have to go completely off the grid, unless you want to, in which case, by all means. But pick and choose. Remember, the heresy of technological choice is the thing I'm trying to talk about here. And it is a heresy. Believers in the religion of progress shriek and clutch their pearls over their neckties. Take your choice when you mention it. But yeah, you can choose what technologies you want. Go ahead, pick and choose, chuck the ones that don't meet your needs, and take a hard look at the ones that you think you need and say, okay, do I actually need this? Or am I just fooling myself? Is it just something that's wasting my time, you know, eating my brain, and I could get much more done without it?
Millions of people in North America and Europe are clueless about how dependent they are on the fossil fuel system until a fire, or an earthquake, or a flood disconnects them, and then 3 days and riots break out. Talk to us about system dependency, John Michael Greer.
Oh, yeah. Basically, most people in modern industrial society are horribly vulnerable, and they're vulnerable because they depend on these vast, sprawling technosystems. It all seems very convenient, as you say, until something breaks down, and things are breaking down more and more often. As the global economy declines, as we run further and further into the depletion of fossil fuels and non-renewable resources, those breakdowns are going to become more and more frequent. On the one hand, the more things you can do without, the safer you are, the easier it's going to be to take care of yourselves and your loved ones. On the other hand, to the extent that you could do without this stuff, you're going to free up space for people who actually do need it. So it becomes very much a matter of, what do you actually need? And then, are there ways you can get it that don't involve being dependent on some vast, sprawling bureaucratic monstrosity that could be taken out by, you know, a 50-cent fuse blowing 500 miles from you?
So you do have some concrete proposals of technologies that could survive our current civilization. You talk about 7 of them, for example. Would you talk about just a couple so we get the idea?
Okay, here's one example. Radio. In every community in the United States, in Europe, in most of the world, in fact, amateur radio used to be a really big thing. Now it's kind of an odd little hobby. But these are people who build, in many cases, they build their own radio equipment. They can, you know, communicate across the planet using a very little electricity and simple gear, the kind of things people were using in the 1950s and the 1920s. And so that's a technology that could survive for the very long term. And it's a technology that's extremely useful right now. Whenever there's a natural disaster, the hurricanes that we've had in Florida and Texas right now, immediately, as soon as that happened, all the ham radio people were getting out there, you know, basically digging themselves out of the rubble, getting an antenna up, firing up their things, and opening and setting up a communications net. That's incredibly important, and that's something that could survive our civilization entirely because, again, you can make this stuff out of some fairly simple material. Another example, and one that's very dear to my heart, is the printing press. One of the things we know about Dark Ages, about what happens when a civilization crashes, if they've got printing, your recovery is much quicker, it's much less problematic, much less traumatic, because you can mass-produce documents. In China, in Japan, they've had several Dark Ages over the last couple of millennia, and they were using woodblock printing. It's a very simple technology. But they could mass produce documents that way. In Europe during the last Dark Age there, they didn't have a printing press until they figured out how to do printing. And every manuscript, every document had to be copied by hand. That really slowed things up. If people can get into printing now, get into simple hand operated printing presses, and pass that technology on, that could go straight through whatever the future has to throw at us and make it much easier for us to recover in the future. Those are two you know, very simple examples, but they're things that anybody can contribute to.
You know, I had a printing press a few years ago myself, and you have to get used to typesetting the letters backwards, but that's another problem. You know, I love it that in this age of computers and prepackaged thought and TV talk shows, you are calling for, quote, a revival of the skills of thinking. Is it too late?
No. The great thing about the human brain is that you can actually learn. You don't have to wait for some, you know, vast corporation to provide you with an upgrade. You can just, like, start thinking. Not only that, a lot of the basic skills of this were worked out 2,000, 3,000 years ago. So most of the bugs are out of the programming at this point. So all you have to do is just start asking yourself hard questions like, how do I know that that's true? And if that were true, then what else would be true so I can check it? And you know, what are some of the basic logical fallacies? This was worked out by the ancient Greeks. What are the kinds of arguments that people go to when they're lying through their teeth? You can identify that. Oh, that's an ad hominem argument. I remember that one. You are full of. So it's not that difficult. It's really easy. Well, every human being that has a functional brain has the capacity to make use of this very, very ancient, very effective tool set. And the amount of annoyance that causes to politicians and marketers, that's just lining up. That's fun. That adds to the fun.
Here's the type of thinking and the type of sentence that brings down critics howling on John Michael Greer. You say, if there's such a thing as a natural human society, the basic dark age society is probably it. Why would you say that?
Well, when you look at history, every society starts out in about the same place. If you take Dark Age European society and Dark Age Japanese society, the bottom of the Sengoku Jidai of the samurai period, if you take Dark Age Greek society before classical Greece started going and so on, they're all basically running the same thing. They've all got, you know, the heroic mythos. They've got a kind of proto-feudal social structure. You could, you know, Gilgamesh and Beowulf could swap monsters and nobody would notice the difference. As a society develops, it becomes more and more differentiated. It goes its own way. It develops its own unique ways of approaching all the various problems that human societies have to deal with. And so it becomes more and more differentiated. So, you know, while, you know, in feudal Greece and feudal England were very similar, by the time you get to the Greek Renaissance and the English Renaissance, they're completely different. And classical Greece and modern England, almost nothing in common. Then the civilization runs itself into the ground. All the usual problems crop up. They, you know, they burn through their resource base. They destroy their environmental basis. They slam face first into the usual problems and go tumbling back down to another Dark Age society. We don't like to think of history as going in cycles, but it is as predictable as the human life cycle. Okay, we're all born. We grow up, assuming we live to grow up. We hit puberty. We go through the usual convulsions of puberty. We mature. We get old. We die. So do civilizations in a very similar pattern. You can, if you look through history, you'll watch it again and again with the same kind of landmarks on the way. And so getting past the fantasy that says, no, we're different. We're going to live forever. We're going to go zooming off to the stars and nothing will ever change for us again. That's nonsense.
But hold on. You think we're in a cycle of time and of history, though, and so you wouldn't agree with Dr. Guy McPherson when he says that near-term human extinction is facing us due to climate change.
He's been predicting that for years. In 2009, he was saying that by 2012, there would be no longer any cars on the road because we'd be all out of oil. Yeah, you know, I appreciate his sincerity and his honesty, but he really needs to study some history and to get an idea of the extent to which we're simply following a familiar pattern.
Have you seen any signs that the retro future you write about is already trying to be born?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right now, for example, sales of electronic books, e-books, are actually declining steadily, whereas sales of printed books are going up again. One of the big social changes in large parts of the English-speaking world these days is people are ditching their smartphones and going back to old-fashioned flip phones or even, heaven help us, landlines. I'm on a landline right now. I don't use a cell phone, by the way. There's a broad awareness that a lot of the things that were done 50 and 100 years ago simply produce better results than the stuff, the equivalent things you get nowadays. And you've started to get people started to cash in on that. People started looking at it and saying, you know, if I produce something using these old techniques, everyone's going to go, oh, that's higher quality. I'm willing to pay a little extra for that. And so we're actually starting to see a movement in a lot of different fields toward a kind of retro culture, a kind of retro technology, by people who simply want something that's good rather than something that's progressive.
We've been talking with the prolific author and blogger John Michael Greer. I just finished his book, and I found it very stimulating. I took a lot of notes, a lot more than we can get into today. His new book is The Retro Future, Looking into the Past to Reinvent the Future. And you can find John Michael's new blog at www.ecosophia.net. And there's links to some of his works in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up, John Michael Greer?
And just, I'd like to encourage everybody to look at the technology in their lives and say, do I actually want this?
It's been a pleasure having you on Radio EcoShock again.
Radio EcoShock.
John Michael Greer says, history is not a straight line. It's a smorgasbord of choices. We can pick this and that. I'm wondering if history is more like an interdependent ecosystem. Is it possible to remove one piece of technology without the surrounding system of that time? For example, the bricolage technique of selection of weapons, who will choose swords when technology of guns is still known, much less missiles and nuclear weapons? Will steam make a comeback? Will horses return as our transportation? He mentions getting in touch with a doctor. Will we go back from medical discoveries? Perhaps we keep those in our smorgasbord, but that means high technology like blood analysis, CT scans, and all that. It takes some form of industrial base to provide those tools at scale. When we pick one item or one field from the present, maybe that tends to rebuild the whole system again. Still, it's clear what Greer is talking about. We don't have to accept every new technology simply because it's being hyped. Choice of technology is a right, or it should be. And people who techno-shame or techno-bully, you know, your TV is so small, your phone is so old, that needs to end. At a deeper level, when you read the book, John Michael Greer is also looking at the long haul. One of his 7 sustainable technologies is intensive organic gardening. We all know fossil fuels and all the chemicals and pesticides made from them will not go on forever. Eventually, those things run out, and perhaps the intensive industrial system that made them will perish as well. Humans, if there are humans, will be doing intensive organic gardening partly because there will be no other choice. Realizing that all civilizations are waves in time which crest and then fall away, maybe we can prepare for the next stage with intelligent choices for a retro future. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. I've got 2 top scientists lined up for next week as we explore extreme climate changes and maybe another way out. I'm Alex Smith, your dedicated nonprofit broadcaster. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
This is the Taylor Report, and I believe we have Stephen Gowans on the line. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes, I am. Hello, Phil.
And it's gowans.wordpress.com, what's left. And Stephen, your book is coming out sometime soon, and it couldn't be more timely, assuming we get to that we survive the present episode. The title of your book is Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, the story of Korea's fight for freedom. When people think of this crisis at the moment, this idea that Korea has fought for its freedom and that that struggle that somewhat it might have involved traitors and such. Tell us where you begin. If I got the date right, you said that the current modern crisis of Korea began in 1905. Is that roughly correct?
Yeah, 1905 is the year that Japan, or the Japanese Empire, declared a protectorate over Korea, and then 5 years later integrated Korea into its empire. And yes, the Koreans have been fighting for their freedom from two empires ever since, the Japanese and the U.S. Empire.
As I was reading your recent summary of the book at your website, and it's gowans.wordpress.com, please go there, I was hearing echoes in the back of my head of the course of the French Empire and what was called French Indochina. And these are almost of a piece, was it not? At the end of World War II, the issue came up, are they going to have self-determination or do they return to the old imperial fold? And the Vietnamese resisted and other people in South Asia resisted. We're now seeing the Ken Burns thing where he's telling the story of how America got involved. But first America tried to save the French, and then the French had to go and the Americans decided to hang on to Vietnam. But in parallel, they were doing the same in Korea, right?
Yes. Exactly. Yeah, there are great parallels between the two. I mean, both were divided, Korea and Vietnam. Of course, Korea remains divided, and Vietnam managed to achieve its independence. But they are very similar, yes. I mean, U.S. troops arrived on the Korean peninsula about a month after the Japanese surrendered, and during that month, Koreans managed to drive Japanese out of administrative positions and collaborators as well, and to start taking their own affairs in their hands. 2 days before the Americans swaggered onto the peninsula, the Koreans declared their own government, the Korean People's Republic. And the United States arrived 2 days later and said that it would not recognize the republic and essentially went to war against it and conducted a war for quite a number of years. There was a major guerrilla war that went on in the south of Korea, which the United States tried to suppress. And it tried to suppress it with a military that it recruited, and it recruited from collaborators with the Japanese. Many of the officer corps had been in the Japanese Imperial Army.
Yes. By the way, we do have amnesia, right? People do not remember all these things or even think about them. But is it? I know in Vietnam, the story, Ho Chi Minh did the same thing, right? He declared, "Okay, now we are a new country." And a unified one, and they said no, you're not. But I think in the case of Indochina, the French recruited the Japanese to help them keep down the Vietnamese. Did a similar thing happen in Korea?
For a few months, the Americans brought the Japanese back, but they quickly got rid of them and replaced them with Koreans who had collaborated with the Japanese, so essentially the same. I mean, Koreans who had been in the Japanese Imperial Army or who had been in the Korean colonial police under Japanese command, these are the people that the U.S. allied with. And the reason they allied with them is that the United States recognized very early on that if left to their own devices, the Koreans would create a communist state. They knew that's the direction in which Koreans wanted to go. They looked to the Soviet Union for direction. It was going to be a leftist, a socialist, indeed a communist country. And the Soviets and the Americans were both on the peninsula. They'd agreed that they were going to divide the peninsula in order to accept the Japanese surrender. But the agreement was that they would leave within 5 years. And within 5 years, there would be elections for a national government. But the United States recognized that Kim Il-sung, who became the founder of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, that he would almost certainly win that election. The same thing happened in Vietnam as well, where the Americans realized that the communists would win the election. So, and they did the same thing. I mean, so they maneuvered to politically partition the peninsula to establish a puppet state in order to preempt the national elections, which would inevitably lead to a communist government.
And to, speaking of the credentials of the fighters and why they would have won an election likely, they had been the allies of the allies who fought Japan and Germany in the war, right? They had, and they had lost fighters. They had sacrificed their blood, and therefore they were regarded as patriots and heroes, the way I suppose the Ho Chi Minh was. And they're up against people who actually were, there used to be a word, compradors, right? People who had, had accommodated Japan, were quite happy with Japan.
Yes, and you know, you said spilled their blood. I mean, the people who founded the or North Korea, and this was founded after the United States created the Republic of Korea or South Korea. And the people who founded that were guerrillas who had spent about 12 years fighting the Japanese within Manchuria and fighting them in order to liberate Korea from Japanese rule. And the Soviets were also instrumental in defeating the Japanese because the Soviets entered the war, I think, 3 months after the end of the war in Europe, which was an arrangement that Stalin had with Roosevelt. And they swept through Manchuria and they swept through the northern half of Korea. So the, Kim Il-sung, the founder of North Korea, said, you know, the guerrillas have spilled blood on behalf of Korea's liberation. The Soviets have spilled blood on behalf of Korea's liberation. And the Americans haven't spilt one drop of blood. They didn't arrive until a month after Japanese had surrendered. I mean, according to...
Yeah, a victory parade wouldn't be terribly impressive.
No. So in their view, the United States had no right to be on the peninsula. However, the Soviets had made that arrangement.
You know, Stephen, you probably remember, I do, that it used to be a little, practically a sing-song rhyme system that the Americans had. Oh, when will the Soviets ever go home? They're occupying everybody. They never leave. Well, they did leave Korea, and China left Korea, but the United States is still there. Even Jimmy Carter had problems with that one, by the way. You remember?
Yes, they never left. They arrived in 1945, in the summer of 1945. The Soviets were there as well, a month before. The Soviets were asked to leave after the DPRK was established, and they did by December of 1948, at which point the United States started talking about, well, it seems kind of embarrassing that we're still here. Maybe we're going to have to leave. There's a declassified CIA report that's available online that you can look at, in which the CIA starts talking about what's going to happen if we actually withdraw our combat troops. This isn't going to work out very well because if we do, I mean, this puppet regime that we've established is going to be overthrown. So there was this reluctance.
By the way, I hope that's in your book. I assume that you will share with us what you found.
Yes. So there was a reluctance to withdraw the troops. But they were, however, the United States left 500 advisors behind, which were
integrated with the Korean military, essentially commanding the Korean military. So the U.S. military presence on the peninsula has been continuous since the summer of 1945.
Mm-hmm. This is Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com. The book, when is the book coming out, by the way?
April of 2018. Oh.
Well, you're going to have to write a few articles in between, cribbing from the book. But this is just many, many people are waiting for this book. It's going to be, the title will be Patriots, Traitors, and Empires, The Story of Korea's Fight for Freedom. What do you make of this present exchange? We have the president of the United States, but, well, we're very much at the mercy, in my mind, of headline writers who give us headlines, for example, that say a war is inevitable, they says the North Korean representative. Is that what he said, or did he say maybe a little more than that?
Yeah, and there's a news story that's just out recently in which the North Korean foreign minister is being portrayed as saying, indeed, that war is inevitable. But others are saying that what he's saying is that if the United States can threaten preemptive military action, then so can North Korea. And this is because the foreign minister had said that if the United States, that essentially the United States had declared war on North Korea, and that if the United States wants to fly B-2 bombers, or was it B-1 bombers? B-1 bombers. Have them prowl along the North Korean airspace, as they did days ago, that the North Koreans would regard this as an act of war and would attack. Mm-hmm. Even if these bombers were still outside of North Korean airspace.
Yeah. Well, they're flying north of the famous parallel, 38th, which is a highly provocative thing to do, is it not? I even saw on CNN today American commentators, former military people, raising their eyebrows about this because when you do something like that with a warplane and it breaks precedent, bad things can happen because you're only playing on your side of the field. The other guy has to make up his mind what he thinks of that.
Yes. Yeah, I know. It's very provocative, but, I mean, the United States does very provocative things. Yeah. And you know, much comment has been made about Trump and the provocative comments he's been making. Mm-hmm. But with Trump, you know, the substance of what he says is never as much of an issue as how he says it, because much of what he says has been said many times before by other U.S. leaders. But somehow people don't get as upset when others say it. But the others have said essentially the same thing. For example, Wesley Clark. Wesley Clark had said that if the North Koreans ever attack South Korea, their nation would be completely destroyed. It would literally cease to exist. Mm-hmm. And that's simply for Koreans.
I remember him. He was Michael Moore's choice to run for the president of the Democratic Party.
Yes.
See, a moderate. That's the definition of moderate. Go ahead.
Clinton had said exactly the same thing in 1993. He said, you know, the North Koreans don't need nuclear weapons because, you know, if they ever use them, their country would no longer exist.
Yeah. She doubled down, of course, saying same about Iran, right? I mean,
yeah.
Iran is a country of 70 million people, so it would cease to exist.
Yes, I believe Hillary Clinton said that, yes.
Yeah.
And Colin Powell had said that North Korea could be reduced to a charcoal briquette. So, you know, these threats of entire annihilation of a country have been made on numerous occasions. And we think about Wesley Clark. Usually they're made in connection with an invasion. You know, if North Korea attacks South Korea, we're going to drop nuclear weapons on them. Which one could argue is certainly a very disproportionate.
By the way, that language has been precluded by international law, the United Nations, and others. Right? You're not supposed to threaten it's not just force, but to threaten massive force of that kind, particularly nuclear. That's supposed to be verboten, prohibited, language.
Exactly. And yet the United States has done it over and over and over again with the North Koreans, and that's one of the reasons the North Koreans say they need nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Well, you notice that Trump, and you're quite right, not any different than Obama and Bush and all the others, they really misrepresent the issues when they rise. For example, Trump is saying, well, we're very grateful to China and Russia for voting for this resolution. But the Chinese and the Russians have been very clear in saying that the U.S. should cease its provocative actions along the border so that North Korea could then back up from the decision to go forward with nuclear weapons. Am I right?
Yeah. And I mean, this is often presented as the North Korean problem. And what's the solution to the North Korean problem? But I'm not sure what the problem is. But if we accept that there's a problem, I know the Chinese and Russians have said, well, Washington says to us, we're not doing enough to solve this problem. But what is Washington doing to solve the problem? Mm-hmm. It's exacerbating the problem. What it could be doing to solve the problem is perhaps looking at the proposal that the North Koreans have made, but now has been attributed to others like the South Koreans and the Chinese. And that proposal was that North Koreans will freeze the development of their nuclear weapons, will stop ballistic missile testing in exchange for the United States agreeing to freeze its provocative war games on the peninsula, which are carried out every year. These are the largest war games in the world, involving hundreds of thousands of troops, and they do them every year over and over and over again.
Well, and provocative actions, you've told us in the past that they take warplanes with dummy bombs and then drop the dummy bombs close to the border.
And they deliberately fly during the day.
Yeah, I mean,
sure that the North Koreans can see them.
At the core of this, part of the core, admitting, I guess, aspects to it, but is it not that there was a war from 50 to 53, and it was, the Americans called it a police action, one of the weirdest terms anybody ever developed. There is a ceasefire, but no peace agreement. Is the problem in getting a peace agreement that the United States does not want to acknowledge the sovereignty of North Korea? What is the problem?
I think ultimately the problem is that the United States absolutely does not want to lose the Korean Peninsula as an extension of the Pentagon. It doesn't want to have to take its troops off the peninsula because its troops having a presence on the peninsula is very beneficial to the Pentagon as a way of balancing or checking China and Russia, which is the real concern. The North Koreans have, on many occasions, made a proposal for reunification. And it's a very reasonable proposal. And the proposal is that a confederal system be developed. So they have one nation, one flag, one country, but they have two systems. So in the north, you'd have kind of like a provincial government, which would have a communist system, and in the south you'd have another provincial government which would have a capitalist system, and then you'd have an overarching federal government which would look after self-defense and foreign affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Very reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's never gone ahead, and the reason it hasn't gone ahead is because of one stipulation that the North Koreans make, and that is there can be no U.S. troops in Korea. And the South Koreans always reject it on those grounds. And the South Korean proposal for reunification insists on maintaining U.S. military presence in Korea.
Wow. Yes. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, and the book is Patriots, Traitors, and Empires. You could probably order it now. The Story of Korea's Fight for Freedom. And Stephen, lastly, everybody leaves out the fact the South Koreans elected somebody who's not such a hardliner, and nobody ever quotes him, and nobody even actually quotes the South Koreans. All we hear is Trump. And if there is a decision to be made about whether or not there will be a confrontation from the point of view of Seoul and Washington, it's actually Washington, is it not, that would make all the decisions? Kind of like Canada.
Yes, Washington would make all the decisions. The Japanese in Manchuria established a state called Manchukuo, which is always called a puppet state. Always. It's always the puppet state of. And as I was researching this, it occurred to me that South Korea, the Republic of Korea, is just as much a puppet state as Manchukuo was. And some historians have even made the point that, you know, the real powers within the Republic of Korea, South Korea, are the U.S. commander who commands the ROK forces, the U.S. ambassador, and the CIA station chief. In fact, at certain points, some of the presidents of South Korea have spent most of their time simply responding to those three people who have really wielded enormous power in South Korea. So I'm not sure it really matters what the South Korean president thinks. In fact, just recently, the South Korean president was meeting with his military and saying, you know, at what point are we going to take control of our own military? Because, you know, we're not threatened by the North Koreans, he said. Look at our budget. Our military budget is four times higher than theirs. We have twice the population. Therefore, we can field twice the number of soldiers, troops. We have 700,000 troops. We have 3.5, that's active duty. We have 3.5 million in reserve. The North Koreans are completely outclassed. So at what point are we going to take control of our own military? Because the generals always say, well, we can't because, you know, we can't defend ourselves. And despite that, despite his complaint, the Americans aren't going anywhere.
He probably came within a hair's breadth of being arrested. Stephen, it's been great talking to you. It's very informative. We need your writing on it's gowans.wordpress.com. Look forward to talking to you again.
Okay, thanks, Phil.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Phil, there's going to be some meetings, events.
There is an event on Saturday, September 30th. That's this coming Saturday at a different book list, Cultural Center at 777 Bathurst Street. And it's a book launch called Why Don't the Poor Rise Up by Jamu Nangwaya and Michael Trussello. And our friend Ajumo Baraka had this to say about it. He said, combining the most creative thought from the global north and south, Why Don't the Poor Rise Up promises to be an indispensable resource for understanding why the new revolutionary movement of the 21st century will emerge from the ranks of the most marginalized by capitalism and colonialism.
So that's an event is what, where?
Saturday, September 30th at 6:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. at a different book list, 777 or 779 Bathurst Street.
Okay. By the way, you can write to us or follow us. Did I say? Yeah, you can even write to us. Facebook.com/TheTaylorReport. And Phil, there's also
SoundCloud.com/Taylor-report.
Thank you. And we hope you will follow us there and listen to the broadcasts of previous, like guys like Gowans, that you really need to know about. I think we will take a little musical break. Is it going to be Lead Belly? Oh, great. Okay, this is Taylor Report. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next. Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joseph Gerson, Disarmament Coordinator with the American Friends Service Committee, who discusses the danger of unintended consequences from Donald Trump's threats and insults hurled at North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Chad Bolt, policy manager with the National Indivisible Movement, who talks about the fight to defeat the Republican Graham Cassidy Obamacare repeal bill and the future of the U.S. healthcare system. And Eric and Jason Ramos, whose parents have been ordered deported back to their native Ecuador after living in the U.S. for 24 years, relate the pain they face on the impending breakup of their family. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
According to Foreign Policy magazine, Afghanistan's Nimruz province is a case study of what went wrong during the 16-year U.S.-led war in Afghanistan. After billions of dollars spent in aid, the province is still controlled by drug lords, smugglers, kidnappers, and a corrupt military. This southern corner of Afghanistan is also a hub for migrants leaving the country for what they hope will be better lives in Iran and Western Europe. To cross the border, traffickers charge $500 per person, twice the salary of an Afghan soldier on the front line. Trucks full of migrants head into the desert toward the Pakistani province of Balochistan, through areas controlled by the Taliban, and into Iran. Migrants face many risks on their journey from criminal gangs, the Taliban, and shakedowns by border guards. Afghanistan ranks as one of the poorest nations in the world, despite benefiting from more aid dollars sent from the United States than was spent rebuilding Europe after World War II. Largely due to rampant corruption, Western money has inflated the power of local strongmen, criminals, and insurgents who undermine the state. In Nimruz province, these non-governmental forces have filled the vacuum left behind by the collapsed provincial government. 2 months after the summer's deadly fire at London's Grenville Tower, former tenant Thomasina Hassel and her son were living in a hotel along with other displaced tower residents. Many tenants were not sure where they would find a new home in a community that had become gentrified and was unaffordable to the working poor. The tower fire, now under criminal investigation, has also exposed the long legacy of Thatcherist economics. For years, cash-strapped local government councils courted private developers to build middle-income homes while public housing tenants got pushed out of London. According to the Christian Science Monitor, low-wage service workers have for many years relied on subsidized social housing as the only affordable option in London, where housing prices skyrocketed 500% since the mid-1990s. Until the late 1970s, social housing had a solid footing in London. But while in office, Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher sold off public assets and placed a freeze on new funding for social housing. More recently, the Conservative government has slashed rental subsidies to local government councils. Across London, social housing has been systematically demolished in favor of middle-income homes, which has resulted in the loss of some 8,000 public housing units over the last decade. 20 years ago, Newton, Iowa was a blue-collar union town, home to a large Maytag factory, lots of good-paying jobs, and a contract with the United Auto Workers. Employees there could look forward to a full pension upon retirement. 15 years ago, before the big recession hit and corporate mergers took its toll, 4,000 workers were employed by Maytag. But in 2006, when Whirlpool merged with Maytag, the Newton plant was shut down, leaving the Rust Belt town in economic freefall. Suffering from a 10% unemployment rate, Newton officials offered a big tax break and their well-trained workforce in the hopes of attracting a new employer to anchor the town's economy. The town signed a deal with wind power turbine maker TBI Composites, a non-union employer. But after a high turnover rate and complaints about poor working conditions, workers at TPI attempted to organize a union in 2013 with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. The union drive failed, and TPI management actively opposed the union. The company brought in a new human resource director who charged that pro-union workers were violating rules governing labor organizing. Fired union activist Dennis Young sought relief from the National Labor Relations Board and won an out-of-court settlement with TPI. Now the UAW and the TPI workers are planning a third union drive at the Newton plant. Young told Indies Times magazine that the non-union wind power manufacturer is ironically now seeking support from green power advocates and environmental groups, including top Democrats on Capitol Hill. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Since Donald Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea in a speech before the UN General Assembly on September 19th, the war of insults between the American president and Pyongyang's leader Kim Jong-un has intensified. After North Korea threatened to detonate a nuclear weapon over the Pacific Ocean, Trump responded with a tweet that the North Korean leader was obviously a madman that would be tested like never before. Later, Trump tweeted that if North Korea's foreign minister echoed the thoughts of President Kim in his UN speech, they won't be around much longer. The exchange of insults continued, with the North's foreign minister, Ri Yong-ho, stating that the U.S. had declared war on his country, and his nation has every right to take defensive countermeasures. He also said Trump's insults make it inevitable that the country's rockets will strike the U.S. mainland. These comments followed soon after the U.S. flew B-1B bombers and F-15 fighter jets in international airspace east of North Korea's coast, the farthest north of the demilitarized zone that U.S. fighters or bombers had ever flown this century. Your reporter spoke with Joseph Gearson, disarmament coordinator with the American Friends Service Committee, who discusses the danger of unintended consequences that could result from the threats and insults hurled by Trump at North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and the conditions that could pave the way for negotiations to reduce tensions that could trigger a catastrophic conflict on the Korean Peninsula and across the region.
This is not the most mature action that we can expect of our leaders, and it's really quite disturbing and frightening. I mean, my concern is that we find a situation in which the words that these leaders have expressed create political realities from which they can't back off. Some of your listeners will remember that back during the Cuban Missile Crisis, at one point, President Kennedy turned to his brother, Attorney General Bobby Kennedy, and said, you know, if I hadn't ratcheted up this crisis, I would be impeached. And so I think it's important for all people who are concerned, really ultimately about human survival, to weighing in on our congressional representatives, saying, look, the obvious way forward on this is to negotiate. I mean, if you go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis, what you find is that even then Secretary of Defense McNamara said early in the crisis, look, it's not worth it because in time Russia will have ICBMs that can reach us. And we're in a situation where in some ways the actions of North Korea in developing against nuclear weapons have their own logic. I mean, obviously, no country should possess nuclear weapons, given what they could do. But the reality is that North Korea has been threatened with nuclear attack by the United States somewhere between 9 and 12 times. And in this circumstance, it's moved to create a nuclear arsenal, I think largely to deter the threats from the United States. And the way forward, obviously, is to sit down and negotiate some form of non-aggression. People talk in terms of freeze for freeze, some form of a diplomatic way forward, which is precisely what happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis when cooler heads prevailed.
It's been said by our politicians, as well as commentators, that the leadership of North Korea is irrational, not to be trusted, and basically saying they're on a suicide mission of some kind. What's the basic framework for possible negotiations that could be kicked off? And I know North Korea has made statements basically saying that they want an end to the Korean War. They also want normalized diplomatic relations. Is there any way that the United States, along with China, which, you know, has provided vital resources to North Korea, could push this agenda at this point? Or are things too frayed and angry?
Well, I think in any negotiations, you know, things move maybe slower than one would want. But, you know, if you go back, I mean, as early, you know, maybe 20 years ago, Scott Snyder of the Asia Foundation was writing about the rationality within North Korea's actions. And former Secretary of Defense Perry has talked about this more recently. And people should remember that Perry and Secretary of State Albright essentially negotiated a comprehensive agreement with North Korea in 1999 and 2000, which was basically thrown out, not fulfilled by the Bush administration early on. I think we need to recognize that the two primary concerns of the North Korean leadership is preservation of the Kim dynasty and preservation of North Korean sovereignty. I mean, those are its bottom lines. And certainly we can negotiate within those frameworks. I mean, we certainly have relationships with more than a few dictatorships around the world. We might begin with Saudi Arabia, but there's a bunch of others as well. So I think we can move to negotiations. Getting to the point of replacing the armistice with a peace agreement will take some time in negotiations, but you build from step to step as you build trust through the negotiations.
Well, Joseph, there's a lot of concern about Donald Trump and his fitness for office. And people around the country have placed a lot of hope in the generals that surround Donald Trump, General John Kelly, Secretary of Defense James Mattis, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Joseph Dunford, and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. There's a lot of faith put in them that they're going to prevent Donald Trump from making any reckless moves that could cost a lot of lives in the Korea Peninsula or here in the United States.
Here, there's even a recent ABC and CNN poll indicating that most Americans trust the generals more than they do Trump. And you know, we in a sense we face a constitutional crisis because we've always our Constitution provides for civilian control over the military. If you go back, for example, to the Cuban Missile Crisis, you can see some of the dangers of having the military in control. So one will hope that through some kind of dynamic between the generals and Trump and our other political leaders, that Trump can be walked back from this perch on which he's placed us all.
That was Joseph Gearson, disarmament coordinator with the American Friends Service Committee. Find more analysis and commentary on the North Korean crisis by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After Senate Republicans' latest unsuccessful attempt to repeal and replace President Obama's signature health care reform legislation, the Affordable Care Act, opponents breathed a sigh of relief. The third failed bill to repeal Obamacare, sponsored by GOP Senators Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and Louisiana's Bill Cassidy, would have ended ACA provisions mandating health coverage, insurance premium subsidies, expansion of Medicaid, and eliminated protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Graham Cassidy went down to defeat after three Republicans announced their opposition, preventing the Senate from using a time-limited rule to pass a health care bill with only a slim majority vote. Apart from minority Senate Democrats who were united in their opposition, a broad coalition of health providers, insurance companies, and patient and retiree advocacy groups worked to defeat the bill. Although the Congressional Budget Office didn't have time to research the full impact of Graham Cassidy, they did project that $1 trillion would be slashed from Medicaid over the next decade. The nonpartisan Brookings Institution calculated that by 2027, 32 million Americans would be without health insurance under the Republican plan. As opponents of the bill across the country participated in protests and flooded senators' offices with calls urging a no vote, activists with a disability rights group, ADAPT, engaged in a civil disobedience action at the only Senate hearing on the bill on Capitol Hill that resulted in 181 arrests. Your reporter spoke with Chad Bolt, policy manager with the National Indivisible Movement that mobilized thousands of their members to defeat Graham Cassidy. Here he reflects on the battle just won and the continuing fight over the future of the U.S. healthcare system.
Right now, under current law, people who are lower income can get subsidies to afford health insurance. Those subsidies would go away. The Graham Cassidy bill destroys Medicaid as we know it in two main ways. First, it ends the Medicaid expansion, which you probably remember after the Affordable Care Act was passed and there was the first Supreme Court case, it became optional for states to expand their Medicaid programs. And what does that mean? It means that more people up to a higher income threshold could be covered by Medicaid. a lot of states, something like 30 states, decided to do that, the Graham-Cassidy bill would end the federal support of the Medicaid expansion, and it would transform traditional Medicaid permanently into a cap system. So right now, under Medicaid, if you're eligible, you can get the care you need, and that's a guarantee. But under the Graham-Cassidy cap system, states would get a certain amount of money per beneficiary, and that would be it. So if the money ran out but you needed more care, you'd have to find some other way to get the care you need because the money would be out. So it destroys Medicaid as we know it. It takes away the subsidies to help people afford insurance. It also throws protections for people with pre-existing conditions totally out the window. There were previous iterations of the Trump care bill that at least had the pretense of allowing states to seek a waiver to let insurance companies discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. This bill totally gets rid of the pretense. They're not even pretending anymore. Discrimination against people with pre-existing conditions back on the table. So those are some of the features. You know, it like other Trump care bills, it defunds Planned Parenthood. This bill would be terrible for women's health. One, again, because Planned Parenthood is defunded, but also because those pre-existing conditions are gone. So if you have had a C-section, if you're a victim of sexual assault, if you've had postpartum depression, your insurance company can once again charge you more. That's not allowed under the ACA, but again, those protections would be gone. So those are just some of the terrible highlights. And yet it has a lot of support on the Republican Party, almost enough support to push it through because of the 7-year political promise that Republicans have made to their campaign donors and to their, you know, the most extreme elements of their party that they would repeal the ACA.
This healthcare debate has been roiling for many years now. Obamacare is certainly not the end-all solution. It's got a lot of flaws. It doesn't cover universally people in this country. And Bernie Sanders and others, John Conyers, have put forward single-payer Medicare for All as a more comprehensive solution to the United States healthcare problems. But as you look at the need to be proactive and putting forward your own agenda, your own positive agenda for healthcare in this country, where do you see Indivisible moving?
Sure. It's a good question. And you know what? I'll say right out of the gate, we support Medicare for All. You know, we want people to have quality coverage. We think healthcare is a basic human right. But, you know, we also know there are some hard truths. We are not in agenda setting power right now. We've got massive constituent power, and we've seen that as we've defeated previous iterations of the Trump care bill. We think we really have the most power in responding right now to what's on the congressional agenda. The Trump administration is in a position to sabotage the ACA, even if these legislative attempts to get rid of it fail. They're in a position to sabotage it from the inside. And we've already seen so many different deliberate examples of this. So our effort to defend the ACA definitely continues.
I just wanted to end on one last note. How much of a central issue will healthcare be in the 2018 midterm elections as far as the Indivisible agenda as you guys engage in campaigning in 2018?
Here's how we look at it. In 2018, members of the Senate that voted to end the ACA were going to try to end their careers. If they voted to take away the ACA, we're definitely not going to forget it.
That was Chad Bolt, policy manager with the National Indivisible Movement that mobilized their members to defeat the Graham-Cassidy Obamacare repeal bill. Learn more about Indivisible and other groups fighting for universal health care by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Before this year,
Most undocumented immigrants who have been caught up in the U.S. legal system for years or decades were allowed to stay in the U.S. as long as they regularly checked in with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, because they weren't deemed a priority for deportation. But under the Trump administration, many now have become targets for deportation. People who have no criminal record are gainfully employed, paying taxes, and integral members of their communities, now face separation from their families by being forced to return to a country they haven't lived in or visited for years. The Ramos family of Meriden, Connecticut, is one such family. After 24 years in the U.S., with two U.S.-born sons, Giaconda and Franklin Ramos were ordered to leave the country on September 29th. But 4 days before their scheduled deportation, about 150 of their supporters held a rally at the federal building in Hartford. 36 of those supporters committed civil disobedience by blocking the entrance to the building and were arrested. Soon after that action, an immigration judge in New York granted the couple a stay of at least 3 weeks to allow their lawyer to continue to press their case. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the rally, as well as a vigil outside the family's home 3 days earlier, where one of their sons, Eric, a 17-year-old college freshman, described his family's ordeal. He's followed by his older brother, 24-year-old Jason, who spoke at the rally before being arrested.
I just want to thank everyone here for coming tonight. It really humbles me to see such a huge crowd and such a big manifestation and seeing unification right in front of my own eyes. You know, as a son, my parents have always taught me to care for one another, and unity, it really is the way that you want to approach life. Because succeeding personally, it is something that is nice and it is something that is a goal, but to share your resources with people who may not have had it as good as you, that makes that success that much better and that much sweeter. Now it's really setting in that I could count the days on my two hands that my parents are going to leave me. And at this point, I still need to stand strong. Because this isn't just for my family, as you can see. It's many other families in this nation, many other families in this town, many other families in this state. We see in front of our own eyes human rights not being treated the way they should be. There's no such thing as a human being illegal. There's no such, you can't be a second-class citizen because we are all humans. And I really appreciate you guys' support. Every day, it honestly humbles me. It goes by quick for me and my brother. At least for me, it feels like it goes by too quick. Me and my brother are happy to take the suffering if we know other families won't have to go through the same thing. We will stand strong. I know me and my brother will succeed for the name of our parents, for the name of immigrants, Hispanics, and just people in general, and being Americans the true way, unifying each other, and working towards a new goal every day, and building a team, building a network, and going towards that goal in a positive way. We will continue. I know me and my brother will succeed. Because my parents, even if they cannot witness everything they've sacrificed for, I know I will make a strong enough noise to let everyone know I am the son of them, and this is what they represent. Thank you all for coming. This means a lot to me.
That was Eric Ramos, 17 years old, speaking at a vigil for his parents at their home in Meriden, Connecticut, on September 22nd. Next, his brother Jason, who's 24, spoke while blocking the federal building on September 25th in Hartford, site of the immigration court, shortly before being arrested with 33 others.
Wrong is wrong. We had to stand up together to this injustice. This injustice is built upon a system that oppresses, discriminates, and throws away human rights, human dignity, human decency. It is a system lacking in scruples. What we have here today is a stand. We're holding a line for the people that could not be here, the people that were torn apart from their families, the people here that are living in fear, the muffled voices, the shackled tensions. We are not creating new tension. This is tension that has already been bubbling, tension that has been in this nation within all of us. We are here today in solidarity with my family that is going to be torn apart from me in less than 5 days. My liberty, my justice, my freedom has already been compromised. My life has been compromised. My family is my life. I am here today to bring to light and to arouse the consciousness of the community at large. For right now, this attack on our community, not just immigrants, is something that we should not stand for. My family and I have been abiding by the law, complying with every sort of circumstance and requirement of us. But I think we hold the law to its highest regard when we stand up against injustice, when we stand up against the things that the law doesn't truly stand for. Right now, we are facing an arbitrary system, an oppressive system, a racist system, a system that is being very, very, very wrong at its core. This administration beforehand and those beyond have built this broken system. We had to stand up and build something enduring, something everlasting, not just for the people affected by DACA, not just for the ideal citizens, not just for the 11 million immigrants that are here in this country today. We need something lasting, something representative of all of us. I thank you all here today for lending me your strength. I thank you all for lending your voices so we can amplify the injustice that is happening to all of us. And I hope to continue to have your support, not just for me, but for the families that are still living in fear. We need to prepare and educate ourselves because that is our power, our heart, all of us here together today. We are the face of America.
That was Eric and Jason Ramos, the sons of Gioconda and Franklin Ramos, who received a stay of deportation on September 25th, 4 days before they were due to be deported back to their home country of Ecuador. Learn more about the Ramos case and others like it by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, KPSQ in Fayetteville, Arkansas, Radio Helsinki in Graz, Austria, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
In abolitionist life, what does it mean to call oneself an abolitionist? The word doesn't mean much today, and it certainly doesn't mean what it meant 150 years ago. Then it meant an end to what some have called America's original sin, slavery. Today, well, it's not a common term today, but it should be. It was the nation's first biracial movement built by blacks and whites to oppose the evil of slavery. But it's important for us today to recognize that when they were active during the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, they were portrayed in the press and spoken about by prominent men in power as madmen and crazy women who dared to oppose something so fundamental to American wealth like slavery. Abraham Lincoln, speaking at New York's Cooper Union before his election, depicted John Brown as a madman and not a member of the Republican Party. It was only after the war that abolitionists were regarded as sane people, not before. There's a lesson here for you all, people at the Abolitionist Forum. That is, don't worry about what people in power or media say about you. Ask yourself, is what you're doing is right? Then roll with it. It's right to oppose mass incarceration. It's right to seek to abolish the racist death penalty. It's right to fight against state repression. And the right time to do that is now. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. The Black Panther Party on screen. When the Black Panther Party emerged in Northern California, October 1966, the images that were projected from that early period were arresting. Young, attractive black men and women, armed for self and communal defense, openly cracked through almost all the images that came before and set a new way of seeing black people. Before, we saw black people praying, marching, weeping, or being savagely attacked by the armed forces of the state. This was, undoubtedly, largely a result of Huey P. Newton's conscious planning, for he knew well how media portrayals shape consciousness. Thus, the Sacramento demonstration, led by Bobby Seale, when armed Panthers entered California's Capitol building, hit with the power of a thunderclap. That event, perhaps more than any other, made millions aware of the party and spurred the first phase of organizational growth at that early period. This was a breakthrough that charged tens of thousands of young black people and attracted them to the party and marked the emergence of the Black Liberation Movement, a distinct formation from the Civil Rights Movement. The Black Panther Party was an expression coming deep from the hearts of black people, and it took monstrous state repression to beat it back down, perhaps best reflected in the assassination of Fred Hampton, December 4, 1969, literally while he slept in his bed. That's America in action. That's America's truest face. That's how the so-called land of the free reacted to the rise of a black freedom movement. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Kneeling for Justice, Kaepernick's demonstration. For former San Francisco 49er Colin Kaepernick, his knee struck a nerve across America. Kaepernick, a talented quarterback, decided months ago to take a knee during the national anthem to bring attention to police terrorism against black people. He is paying a steep price for his principled activism and protest in ways non-athletes can barely conceive. For professional athletes aren't just guys and gals playing in a sport for entertainment. Elite athletes, especially at the professional level, have spent much of their lives, even as far back as high or middle school age, to build their bodies, to perfect their craft. This single-minded devotion to a sport creates a focus that few of us ever achieve. That Kaepernick is sacrificing his professional career in the face of NFL hostility, speaks well of the man. His sustained protest brings to mind the anti-war efforts of the late Muhammad Ali, who, because his license to box was taken from him, was denied the ability to perform his craft when he was at the very top of his game. He lost, surely, for a time, but so did his millions of fans. Similarly, track and field athletes John Carlos and Tommy Smith ran and won their races at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico. Smith and Carlos were subjected to years of repression after they raised their fists in black power salutes during the medal ceremonies. Colin Kaepernick follows in that proud and principled tradition, for by taking a knee, he is standing for justice for millions whose voices can't be heard. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
What practical impacts could a non-binding referendum on Kurdistan independence from Iraq have on the stability of the Middle East region? What would an independent Kurdistan mean for Kurds across the region? How will non-Kurdish ethnic groups in places like Kirkuk fare if an independent Kurdistan became a reality? Why would Turkey threaten to stop oil exports out of the Kurdish region if they gain economically from those exports? What kind of hardships are the people of the region facing, and would they be resolved if Kurdistan were to separate? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a look at the recent independence vote in Iraqi Kurdistan and the overwhelming endorsement of separation from the rest of Iraq, and what it means for Iraq, the larger region, and the world, and whether it is the Kurdish people or larger imperial powers that benefit from the overall situation. We'll get a historical perspective from Professor Henry Heller. We'll get the view from a Canadian of Kurdish extraction. And we'll hear from journalist Joe Loria, who was in the capital city of the Kurdistan region during the referendum vote. He'll offer his thoughts about activities on the ground and the motivations of the larger powers. On this week's program, Deconstructing the Kurdistan Referendum: The Winners, the Losers, and the Fate of a Region. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 29th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on occupied Anishinaabe territory and the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Netanyahu ordered the Interior Ministry, quote, to evaluate revoking the citizenship of those who call for the destruction of the State of Israel, unquote. In 2011, legislation authorized Israel's Supreme Court to revoke the citizenship of Israelis convicted of terrorism or espionage, the measure directed at Arabs, not Jews. In March 2016, Netanyahu sought Attorney General Mandelblit's authorization to deport families of Palestinian activists for justice to Gaza, falsely calling them terrorists. At the time, Israeli Intelligence and Atomic Energy Minister Yisrael Katz urged their deportation to Syria. Mandelblit wanted none of it, during a security cabinet meeting, saying, proposed deportations violate international and Israeli law. That comes from the article Deporting Palestinians by Stephen Lendman, posted September 27th. Syria's government is the creation and perpetuation of localized special interests, backed by various alliances ranging from the former Soviet Union in the past to Russia, Iran, and to a lesser degree China in present day. The United States and its Arab partners, particularly Saudi Arabia, have engineered militancy along and within Syria's borders beginning in 2011 for the explicit purpose of overthrowing Syria's government and dividing what remains of the nation among proxies and client regimes controlled from Washington, London, and Brussels. In Myanmar, while the U.S. and its Saudi partners are apparently fueling militancy among the Rohingya population, it was the U.S. itself who for decades built up the political networks of the current ruling regime, with Aung San Suu Kyi, a whole cloth creation of Western media narratives, immense funding and political support, and a carefully crafted facade to obfuscate from the public for decades the true nationalist and even genocidal nature of Suu Kyi's supposedly Buddhist nationalist support base. An extensive 2006 report by Burma Campaign UK titled Failing the People of Burma, PDF, would reveal how virtually every facet of Myanmar's current government is a creation of Western political and financial support. That comes from the article Analysis by Analogy, Myanmar is Not Syria, by Tony Cartolucci, posted September 27th. There is enormous pressure and a lot of money working to rehabilitate Vietnam, to put the guilt and the shame of it behind us. But it was precisely the guilt of the people, their shame at what was being done in their name, and their courage to denounce it that made it impossible for their government to carry out the savagery any longer. Would that we had that kind of guilt, shame, and courage among us today. Remember, if we had to lie about it, it was wrong. That is as true today as it was then, is it not? That comes from the article, There is No Rehabilitating the Vietnam War, by Robert Freeman, posted September 27th, originally appearing at Common Dreams. At the beginning of Ken Burns' new documentary on the American War in Vietnam, the narrator says the war, quote, was begun in good faith by decent people out of fateful misunderstandings, American overconfidence, and Cold War misunderstandings, unquote. The early American involvement in Vietnam can be marked by two things in particular. One, helping the French imperialists in their fight against the forces led by Ho Chi Minh of North Vietnam, and two, the cancellation of the elections that would have united North and South Vietnam as one nation because the U.S. and its South Vietnam allies knew that Ho Chi Minh would win. It was that simple. Nothing of good faith or decency in that scenario. No misunderstandings. That comes from the article Cold War Then, Cold War Now by William Bloom, posted September 27th, originally appearing at williambloom.org. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The autonomous region in northern Iraq, known as the Kurdistan region or Iraqi Kurdistan, held an independence election on Monday, September 25th. The result was overwhelmingly in favor of splitting from the rest of Iraq. The population in the capital Erbil was reportedly jubilant. However, the Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi deemed the referendum to be unconstitutional, and the Iraqi parliament has called for the deployment of troops to the nearby city of Kirkuk to take control of the oil fields there. The Turkish government is threatening to cut the tap on the oil pipeline on which the oil exports out of the country depend. The Kurds have had long-standing grievances with governments in both countries. To put this week's referendum in some kind of historical context, we're joined by Henry Heller. He is a professor of history at the University of Manitoba. He's also the author of several books, including The Bourgeois Revolution in France, 1789 to 1815, and The Capitalist University, The Transformation of Higher Education in the United States, 1945 to 2016. Thank you, Professor Heller, for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. I'm glad you called me and I can participate in this interview.
Who are the Kurds and what distinguishes them from other ethnic groups in the region?
I believe the Kurds go back quite a long way. And I think they, as my memory recalls, they may be connected but historically with the Medes, who were an ethnic group which Saul already mentioned in antiquity. So they're very old people. They're mainly Islamic. I think that they're, some of them practice other religions, but I think they're mainly Islamic. They have a distinctive language. And I think what is notable about them in the modern period is that whereas the aspirations of the Arabs, at least formally, were recognized in the 20th century, and essentially Arab states were able to establish themselves in the wake of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, the Kurds, who in terms of geography are to be found in what is now Turkey, Iraq, and Iran, were never able to satisfy their national aspirations for a state. And they've had since the middle of the 20th century this ongoing struggle to try to somehow carve out some sort of national state from these two states, these three states, the Turkey, Iran, and Iraq. And they were frustrated in their attempts, or suppressed, by these three governments, Iran, Iraq, and Turkey, for many years. The American invasion of Iraq changed the situation because, in effect, the central government in Iraq lost control of northern Iraq. With American support, the Kurds were able to basically create an autonomous zone. And what they've done now with this referendum is basically they've declared by a large majority that they wish to be independent, which has implications for Iraq, but also for Syria and Turkey as well, and Iran as well, all of the states in the region. An independent Kurdish state would have serious implications.
Mm. Well, I mean, there are these there are Kurdish populations in Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. I mean, to what extent are these populations interchangeable? I mean, they all identify with as Kurds, but you know, could you are there any critical differences?
Yes, I understand. Well, the Kurdish population is socially differentiated. There are more or less wealthy Kurds. There are middle-class Kurds. There are some workers, and there are peasant farmers. And these groups have different interests. And the largest party amongst them was a party which for many years, the PKK, I think it's called, was explicitly Marxist. And
not everybody who was a Kurd agreed with the left-wing politics of this party. I think more recently it may be that this party has sort of inflected its politics, and one sees a kind of a movement towards a kind of more communitarian anarchist tendency amongst the more radical Kurds. That's what I would say.
Now, in terms of what's going to result, there was a statement from an Iraqi official, and he basically accused quote-unquote racist Kurds of trying to establish a second Israel that will throw the region into years of conflict. I don't know. I'm seeing some parallels there between, like, you know, Zionist Jews seeking their own homeland and the you know, these Kurds forming their own country. I'm wondering, are the similarities and the critical differences between those two? I mean, a second Israel and, you know, everything that that implies in the public imagination would seem to be a reason for concern. But what are your thoughts about that comparison?
I would say, on the one hand, the Kurds have been in the region for thousands of years, and I think that and it's problematic because the establishment of a national entity, a state for the Kurds, would be against the national interests of the Iranians, the Iraqis, the Syrians, and the Turks. And so it's a threat. But I would say that the difference is the difference between these Kurds and Israel, that Israel is a relative, is an intruder into the area. And I don't think you could say that about the Kurds. But the reference that is made is also related to the fact that it seems evident that the Israelis are behind the scenes supporting the Kurds. And they're doing that in order to basically weaken all of these Arab states. And so there is this Israeli-Kurd connection. Mm-hmm. I think that also is in play in this situation.
So as a historian, I mean, given the kinds of dynamics that seem to be materializing, What is your take on the meaning of this overwhelming vote in favor of independence? Is a civil war imminent, perhaps, or some kind of conflict with the neighboring states? You know,
I guess I would say that the region, of course, is very unstable, and this makes it worse because, in the first place, I mean, Iraq, which is de facto a divided country between the Sunnis in the south, the Shiites in the middle, and the Kurds in the north. Now the Kurds are basically saying, with this vote, that they wish to be completely independent of the rest of Iraq. It's a virtual vote of secession. So it is a final and grievous blow to the idea of Iraq as an integral state. They say, you know, a state with real sovereignty. And that means that Iraq is permanently truncated and weak. But also, and this is, I think, a very important aspect of this, an independent Kurdish state in the north of Iraq becomes a pole of attraction for Kurds living in Syria, Iran and Turkey, and the aspiration being to for all of the Kurds in all of these states to unite together. And if, in fact, this Kurdish state were to come into existence in northern Iraq, that would be the focal point for the carving out of Kurdish territories and their amalgamation with this Kurdish state. For example, in Syria, as a result of the civil war, the Kurds already have virtual autonomy within Syria. And one could see them easily linking up with such a state. And so on in Iran and in Turkey. So all of these states, their very existence would be threatened by a Kurdish state.
Well, it's very, very fascinating development that seems to be getting underplayed in the media, in my view. But I want to thank you very much for sharing these insights with us.
Sure. I'm glad to talk to you about them. I hope I've been able to throw some light on what's going on there. And I would say that it's important for the listening public to look behind the flashing headlines and to try and sort of understand the more fundamental, to look for stories in the media and online, and they're usually online, which you know, delve deeper and more deeply into the background to some of the things that are happening. And I think it's very important in particular to be aware of the machinations of the great powers, and especially of the United States and Israel, when it comes to this Middle Eastern politics.
Well, we'll certainly have to see how these events evolve over the coming weeks and months. Thank you for your time.
Okay.
We've been speaking with Henry Heller, professor of history at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Provide a Kurdish perspective on Monday's referendum and its aftermath, we reached Namatullah Emri. He is a Canadian citizen of Kurdish extraction living in Winnipeg. He's the vice president of the Kurdish Association of Manitoba. Mr. Emri, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having this interview with me.
Now, please tell us, how did you and fellow Kurds living in Winnipeg, in the Winnipeg community, receive the news of the vote when it came in?
Well, this is a dream of Kurds for 100 years, since World War First. This is a dream of to have an independent country, to have an independent voice. And this is a right given to every nation, everybody in the world, that taken away from the Kurdish people. So this is like a dream to come true.
What are friends and relatives and contacts in the region telling you about what's been happening there since voting day?
Well, everything is so far looks good there, but expected, like we see a lot of things going on the news. There is a lot of relation between Turkish, Kurdistani, Kurds from Turkish side and the Kurds from Iraqi side, a lot of economical relation, a lot of businesses. Like for example, in Erbil, there are 1,300 companies established by the people from Turkey. So of course, there's a lot of fear there. Something is going to, if they close everything, what's going to happen? But we know that these are all games. Turkey and Iran and Iraq, they are playing some scary games, try to scare some the Kurdish people there. They've been doing these games for years and years and years. If you see like a country like Turkey, Iran, and Iraq, really they have never been close to each other when it comes to the general discussions or the view of the world or anything. They all have their own agenda and basically run their country in a different path. But when the question is the Kurdish people, they all get together. They all get together like they've done in history, like many, many, many times, to have to attack or have to diminish the Kurdish movement.
As you know, the Iraqi government has been saying they won't respect the vote, let alone negotiate terms. They're shutting down flights to and from Erbil as of today, Friday the 29th. Additionally, Turkey is threatening to shut the tap on oil exports out of Iraqi Kurdistan. Is there any concern that the situation could get worse for Kurds in the region?
Well, we are concerned. Of course we are concerned. This is not only going to hurt the Kurdistan part of Iraq, it's also going to hurt the Turkey as well. As you know, Kurdistan Regional Government is the second largest country for Turkey dealing with economic-wise. Basically, they're one of the biggest trade partners for Turkey. So all these goods and services from Turkey also go to Kurdistan region. It's going to affect the Turkish economy. As you know, Turkey doesn't have that many friends around it. So this is going to affect them and also going to affect the people who are living in Kurdistan. At the end, both sides, the Kurds are going to be paying the bill.
Now, there have been some fears that have been raised about how the non-Kurd minorities, Turkmen and Arabs, would be treated in an independent Kurdish state, particularly Kirkuk, which is in disputed territory. Do you feel such concerns are legitimate?
Not really.
No?
To be honest with you, this is the worst thing we can worry about. Because as a Kurd, for the years and years and years, as of now, as you see, we are fighting for freedom for every nation in Middle East, not only for our nation. If we have that agenda, we would have a free Kurdistan long, long time ago. Our mainline stream is the Kurdistan Regional Government also wants that, have a free country for all the nations living in the area. It's not only going to be for the Kurdish people. We have a very good example of it in Rojava. When in Syria, the Kurdish people are including all other nations in their meeting, in their community, is also the co-leadership for all these areas. So we are a nation are fighting for our freedom. When we're fighting our freedom, we are not going to diminish for the nation's freedom who are living with us. We're going to help them. We're going to support them. That should be our mandate.
As I understand it, a lot of oil has been sold out of the Kurdistan region, largely in defiance of the central government. And you've got a lot of the proceeds coming out of that. And then, if Turkey does, in fact, shut down that tap, as they are threatening, that could cause a lot of economic hardship, no?
Well, I'm not that much familiar with internal part of KRG, Kurdistan Regional Government, dealing with the other countries. But as I know, Iraqi government had an agreement with the Kurdistan Regional Government how to share the income of the area or the country. They were supposed to pay 17% of income to the Kurdistan Regional Government for support the people living there. As we know, they did not hold their bargaining part, and then they didn't, even for months and months and years, this money didn't come from the Iraqi government to the area. So there was they didn't have any other choice to sell the oil to support the area themselves. And as we know, there are almost 2 million refugees right now living in Kurdistan Regional Kurdistan Regional Government area with no help from anybody else. And the second thing is shutting down the oil pipe, it's not that easy. Turkey has an agreement with this government. Lots of other countries have an agreement with the Kurdistan Regional Government. I don't know. It's just that easy to shut up the pipe there. There must be some other alternative. Somebody has to pay for consequences.
Okay, Mr. Emery, we really appreciate your time, and we look forward to following this story as it develops. So thank you.
I appreciate for you to reaching us. And also I want to know that there isn't any other nation than Kurds paying price for democracy, for freedom, not only for themselves, for the region. We are at the front line. we pay price with our blood, with our brave Peshmerga and guerrillas. They are fighting for freedom of not only for Kurds, for all, everybody in the world, and especially in the Middle East. So I think the world owe us an apology, and it is time for that. It is time to support the Kurdish movement. It is the time for support the Kurdish independence. Can you please tell me, is there anybody in the world that the nation wants to get to be independent, better freedom, live in peace and prosperity, and somebody else say that, no, that's not good? Well, if it's peace and prosperity and freedom is good for one nation, it should be for everybody in this world.
Mr. Emery, thank you for your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Namtula Emery. He is a Canadian of Kurdish extraction. He's the vice president of the Kurdish Association of Manitoba, and we spoke to him here in Winnipeg. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. What are the larger regional ramifications of Monday's referendum vote? Preliminary indications suggest increased tensions, particularly with Turkey and the Iraqi government. But how exactly will events unfold, especially for the ethnically mixed Iraqi city of Kirkuk, which was included in the referendum vote? Joe Loria is a veteran foreign affairs journalist. He has written for the Boston Globe, the Sunday Times of London, and the Wall Street Journal, among other newspapers. He spent a lot of time in Erbil and was there for the referendum vote. He wrote an article on the eve of the vote and published it at Consortium News. It's called Vote by Iraqi Kurds Adds to Tensions. He joins us from Cairo. Joe Loria, we've seen intense reactions to the referendum result, both from Kurds and from regional governments. How appropriate is that, given that this was supposedly a non-binding referendum?
I think it's totally inappropriate, an overreaction, and a dangerous one. This referendum, as you say, was purely the expression of the will of the Kurdish people of northern Iraq for independence. It has not been followed and will not be followed by a declaration of independence. And there's only one country in the world, Israel, that has supported this referendum and has said publicly they would support and recognize an independent Kurdistan. So this referendum will die of its own accord if nothing happens. Why? Because Masoud Barzani, the leader, long-term leader of the Kurds in Iraq, has said repeatedly that there won't be a declaration of independence, but what he sees from this referendum is a mandate for him to negotiate with Baghdad the independence over 1 to 2 years. But Baghdad will not enter into negotiations over independence. So there won't be any talks, there's no recognition. And if Turkey and Baghdad did nothing, this would just end as an expression of the political will of the Kurdish people and the semi-autonomy that they have enjoyed since 1991 and even more so since 2003, American invasion, will just continue the way it is. In other words, the status quo will continue if Turkey and Baghdad do nothing. But they are not doing nothing. They are acting in a nationalistic and chauvinistic and aggressive way, claiming that this is a threat to their security. The neighboring countries of Iran and Syria are also opposed because they feel it's going to stir up their rest of the Kurdish populations. But they've had trouble with that for decades in Turkey. The Kurds there have been fighting for 30 years against the Turkish state for independence and have not succeeded. They don't need this referendum in Iraq to spur them on, because they've been spurred on for 3 decades. In Iran, there was a celebration on Tuesday and was reported of Kurds in northern Iran, and it was reported that the Iranians are arresting leaders because they displayed the Kurdish flag and sang the Kurdish national anthem, which are both illegal in Iran. And Syria is far more complex. We can talk about that more later. But basically, Syrian Kurds are fighting with the central government in Damascus against ISIS and al-Qaeda. So the government has tolerated their calls for autonomy. They don't want independence. They want something like what exists now in Iraq, an autonomous government. They had elections last weekend, Syrian Kurds, for local councils, and they are having an election in January to create their first parliament. But that will be all sorted out once that war in Syria ends.
Now, I mentioned that you happen to be in Iraq, in Erbil, the day of the referendum. Could you just talk a little bit about what you observed and maybe some of what you experienced getting out?
Yes, I was in Erbil and for a rally on a Friday before the referendum on Monday, which at a football stadium there where Barzani spoke. There was an enormous amount of celebration going on. The fireworks began a week before, literal fireworks. People driving their cars down the middle of the thoroughfares, flying the Kurdish flag, blaring their horns. It was as if they'd won the World Cup, and as if they were going to become a sovereign state the day after the referendum, which, of course, is not true, as I explained. So the day of the referendum itself was extremely calm. People voted. There wasn't a lot of celebration that day, but the next day it started up again, of course. And I feared that they would block flights coming out of Iraqi Kurdistan. I thought at the time that the reaction would be not military, not a military intervention, although that's being threatened, but an economic blockade and closing down of all the borders. And so I flew out on Wednesday morning here to Cairo. And later that day on Wednesday, the Baghdad government gave the Kurds 3 days to turn over the airport and all the borders to the central government. Now, the Kurds have refused to do that. So a little bit later today on Friday, this flight ban will go into effect. And most international carriers have already stated that they will cease flying into and out of Erbil and Sulaymaniyah, which is the other airport in Iraqi Kurdistan. So I was able to get out in time. Otherwise, I may have been stuck in a country where, if there is an economic blockade, life will become extremely difficult.
Well, it's interesting. I was talking to a gentleman locally from the Kurdish diaspora, and he was he didn't seem that concerned about that aspect of it. I mean, he mentioned that. In terms of this blockade, I mean, that there's a level of there's already agreements between the KRG area and and other countries. So shutting down these pipelines would not be so easy. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, Turkey stands to lose a lot if there's an economic blockade. First, these oil sales, which Baghdad says are illegal because they should go for the central government, have been being sold at a discount to Turkey. There's talk amongst Turks that I know that Erdogan is personally profiting from it, and so is Barzani. So there would be also a great loss, billions of dollars a year in trade between Turkey and the Iraqi Kurdish area. They import most of their food from Turkey and Iran, 70% from Turkey and about 30% from Iran. The Iraqi Kurds are not self-sufficient in food, although they have very fertile soil. They preferred to import this food. They claim that they have the Kurds' 6 months of wheat supplies. Turkey would be hurt by this blockade as well. So that might give them pause. Baghdad is not trading very much with the Kurdish regions, so they would be less affected by an economic blockade. But this is what's been threatened. Erdogan said yesterday that he would only buy oil from the central government now. And the Baghdad government has said they're going to shut down all the borders and the airport this afternoon at 5 p.m. local time, or 6 p.m. local time. So we shall see how long that blockade would last. Your friend that you spoke to, the Kurd you spoke locally, might be right in saying because of the impact it would have on Iran as well, on Turkey especially, on Russia, which has the largest foreign investment in the oil sector in the Kurdish region, that this blockade might not last very long. And it's unnecessary, as I said at the beginning, because this referendum is not going anywhere if there are not going to be any talks towards independence, which Barzani wants over the next 2 years. So it could just come and go, and nothing will change. The status will remain the same, and there's no reason for this overreaction from Baghdad and Ankara. But that's what we've had, and maybe they'll come to their senses and realize that they're hurting themselves and this is unnecessary.
Now, it seems to me, just continuing with Turkey, I mean, it's not just the government, but Turkish businesses are very, like, literally invested and all over the Kurdish region, this Kurdistan region. So, I mean, I can understand on the other hand, there are concerns about, you know, some sort of a Kurdish being inspired in the southeast of their country. So, I mean, I'm wondering, is there some kind of a third way for them to explore where they don't have to worry so much about, you know, the Kurdish you know, drive for independence at the same time protect those business interests?
Yes, they could just do nothing. And as I said, the referendum in the Iraqi Kurdish region will amount to nothing if nothing is done. And nothing will be done because there won't be talks with Baghdad over independence. So there are billions of dollars, as I said, in trade from Turkey to the Iraqi Kurds, and that will be lost if this embargo is in place and continues for long. So I think Turkish business interests would pressure the government not to continue with this embargo. They've been fighting 30 years, these Kurds. In Turkey, I don't think this referendum makes a whole lot of difference one way or the other about that war that continues and will continue for the foreseeable future inside Turkey. So there's no reason for Turkey to act at all. But, you know, this is Erdogan. He's quite an authoritarian leader and a bombastic leader, and he has to say something. He has to do something. He has, you know, interest, too, in northern Iraq. He's never accepted, as many Turks have not had, the settlement after the First World War, because the first Treaty of Sevres gave they never accepted the defeated Ottomans that this Veliaht of Mosul, which includes the Kurdish areas, would belong to Baghdad. And they never accepted that. They still have some kind of claim over northern Iraq. But, you know, if Turkey and Iraq jointly invade from the north and they're holding maneuvers about a kilometer north of the Iraqi border, which I think is highly unlikely, I don't think the Iraqi government would want Turks to stay there and claim the territory. It would be to put down this Kurdish referendum, which is not a declaration of independence. So I don't see an invasion. I do not see a long-term blockade either. I think Turkey will come to their senses and realize that their own interests are being hurt by trying to punish the Kurds when this referendum really isn't as great a threat to their national security as they say that it is.
You mentioned earlier that Israel is the only vocal supporter of an independent Kurdistan. Do you read more into that than just affection for the Kurdish people and their freedom-fighting ways?
Oh, yeah, certainly I do. I think the interests of Israel have been borne out over the decades. They've had a close relationship with Iraqi Kurds since the 1960s. In the 1970s, they, with the Shahs of Iran and the United States, armed Kurdish rebels, the Peshmerga, against the central government in Baghdad. That was unceremoniously ended overnight when Iran, under the Shah and the Iraqi government, with Vice President Saddam Hussein, they made an agreement in Algiers to settle the differences that they had. And one of the conditions that Iraq demanded was that Iran stop supporting the Kurds in the north, and they did overnight, cut them off. Israel did the same. Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State at the time, apparently reportedly made a rude remark about the Kurds and cut them off. So the Israelis, you know, used them against the government of Baghdad, which they had seen as a threat and continued to see as a threat. So Israel's interests in an Iraqi Kurdistan, in an independent Iraqi Kurdistan, are twofold. One, to break up states in the region, Arab states that they consider to be their enemies. This has been a long-standing defensive position of the Israeli government. So by cutting off Kurdistan from the north, this weakens and divides Iraq. They would certainly like to see that happen because the other reason is the Israelis will be able to legally operate from Kurdish territory out of an embassy, and they could penetrate the Iranian border and stir up the Iranian Kurds there and supply them. If they would try anyway, because they would like to see the break up Iran as well. We We know that the U.S. and Israel have been involved in Baluchistan and the south of Iran. So breaking up Iran, which is considered the number one enemy of the Israelis now, is certainly an objective of theirs. And under Saddam, that was the largest enemy of Israel, and the American invasion took care of that by weakening Iraq, although it gave power to Shia in the south, and the Shia central government, with enormous Iranian influence there. So this is Israel's interest. Now, there's also been talk here, I've heard from a source who's close to Barzani, that both Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have privately told the Kurdish officials in northern Iraq that they also support the referendum, but they've made no public statement in that regard. And I think maybe the Americans, who were against the referendum as well, saw to that they would not make a public statement. Well, also, the Arab League was against this referendum, and Saudis and the Emiratis are part of the Arab League as well, so they wouldn't want to oppose that. But I don't know if that's true, but that's possible, because the Emiratis and the Saudis have the same interests as the Israelis do in their opposition to Iran and to the Baghdad government, they would like, which is Shia run, so they would like also to weaken Iraq and have a way to get into Iran.
Now, you wrote an article just a day before the referendum, or it was published a day before the referendum, and it's called Vote by Iraqi Kurds Adds to Tensions. And in that article, you did speak quite at some length about the city of Kirkuk, which is a very ethnically mixed city whose demographics has shifted over the course of the 20th century. What kinds of dynamics are playing out there with regards to this non-binding vote? Is there anything there that you'd like to elaborate on as a major focus of concern?
It is a major focus of concern. It's the place where violence, if there is going to be violence, is most likely to break out. The city of Kirkuk was, in the early 20th century, largely a Turkmen city, because the Ottomans, who still controlled it, moved a lot of Turkish speakers into that city. When oil was discovered, and it's the richest oil area of northern Iraq, in the 1920s, Kurdish and Arab workers were moved in there, so the demographics shifted. But there's not been a census since 1957, so we don't really know what the demographics of the city is. What happened in 2014, when ISIS came on the scene and took over Mosul, when the Iraqi army fled, they took Mosul. The same thing happened in Kirkuk. The Iraqi army fled. The Kurds no longer claim Kirkuk had Turkmen and the Arabs. They took control of the city.
Joe, I think you're going to have to repeat that a little bit. You just kind of went fuzzy there for a second.
All right. The city of Kirkuk has a complex history. In the early 20th century, the Ottoman Empire brought in a lot of Turkish speakers. It was a largely Turkmen city, but in the 1920s, a lot of Arab and Kurdish workers, when oil was discovered, that's the richest oil area in northern Iraq. We haven't had a census since 1957, so we don't really know what the demographics of that city is. But what happened in 2014, when ISIS took Mosul, the Iraqi army fled, and they are then threatened Kirkuk, which is claimed by the Kurds, the Turkmen, and the Arabs. One reason the Kurds claim it is because in the 70s, I should add, Saddam Hussein's government had a program of Arabization. They moved out forcibly Kurdish families and put Arab families there to try to change the demographics. And after the American invasion in 2003, a lot of Arabs fled and Kurds moved back in who had been expelled. So, but again, we don't have a census since 1957, so we don't really know was in control. But in 2014, the Peshmerga blocked the ISIS from taking Kirkuk, and they have provided security and controlled the city ever since. In the last 3 years, the governor of the Kirkuk government or province is a Kurd. He was fired by the Iraqi parliament right after the referendum, and he's refused to step down. So Shia militia have stated publicly that if Kirkuk became part of a independent Kurdistan, that they would fight, they would go there and fight. But most alarmingly, the parliament in a 12-point list of demands that they made the other day on the Kurdish government in Erbil has stated that they will send Iraqi National Army troops to Kirkuk to take the city from the Peshmerga. That's really where violence could occur, because the Kurds would fight and there would be bloodshed. That hasn't happened yet, and hopefully it won't.
Now, why do we talk about that kind of big elephant in the room, the United States? Now, vocally, they've been speaking a lot about having concerns about this this vote. You basically saying that it's going to destabilize things in the region, and that I mean, there was even a quote about you know, from an army colonel talking about it. Yeah, it's going to be undermining the fight against ISIS. But you know, I tend to think the United States usually aligns itself with Israel in a lot of these issues, and it seems to me the United States might also benefit if you had another Kurdistan, especially one aligned with Israel, smack dab in this very oil-rich area. I mean, what do you think? Is the United States blowing a lot of steam, or do they really mean what they say?
It's not completely clear, although a lot of people in the Kurdish area believe that secretly the U.S. does support an independent Kurdistan, as you say. But publicly, they have their position has remained that they want a territorial integrity of Iraq, to Iraq to remain in a single country. You'll recall after the invasion, Joe Biden and others talked about the breakup of Iraq into three Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish states. So there has been a position of some American officials, some high-ranking American officials. But right now, I think there might be some sincerity about the issue of ISIS, because if the Iraqi National Army, as I said, does divert troops to Kirkuk and other disputed areas with the Kurds, that would divert their war from ISIS. So ISIS would benefit from that. Now, ISIS has been defeated in Mosul, but there are pockets that still remain. They're not completely defeated. They could come back again. In fact, just yesterday there was a report that al-Baghdadi, the head of the Islamic State, is still alive, that there, a video of his was released in which he's talking about current issues. So ISIS is not a defeated force, and this referendum can divert attention from defeating them, and it was probably ill-timed in that way as well. Now, the State Department is the one who's said the strongest things against the referendum. They threatened to withdraw U.S. and U.N. support for negotiations with Baghdad and the Kurds. But a couple of days now after the referendum, the U.S. said they'll support those negotiations, not independence negotiations, but negotiations over these outstanding issues of oil and borders and the disputed areas. So that was a hollow threat by the United States. We haven't heard from the CIA or the Pentagon, don't really know what they have. There's some members of Congress who've come out in favor of an independent Kurdistan. So maybe at some point down the line, the U.S. would support this, but certainly not as ISIS is not defeated. And they're correct, and I don't often agree with the State Department, but I do hear that everyone should calm down, that meaning Turkey and Baghdad, and not take any rash actions, whether the economic or military, against the Kurds, because this is a non-binding referendum that had no declaration of independence attached to it. It's not changing the status quo legally of the Kurdish region. There's no reason to take these aggressive moves against them, because I think this referendum will simply pass without any effect if nothing is done. So the U.S. is wise, I think, to call for calm right now, and I hope that they were able to have some influence over their allies in Ankara and in Baghdad.
Okay. I mean, just kind of just exploring the prospects of sovereignty for people in the Kurdistan region. I'm just looking at the level of Turkish business interest and investment in that region, and I'm wondering, even if you could get an independent Kurdistan, would it truly be self-governing, or would interference from Turkish and United States and other business interests turn it into more like a pre-Castro Cuba, again run by Turkish, Israeli, and U.S. business interests? Do you have any thoughts about that, this idea of a truly democratic, self-governing, an autonomous Kurdistan?
Well, it already is, to a large extent, run by outside business interests or influenced by it. Certainly, there's a lot of American investment here. There's European investment here. There's Russian investment here. They're the largest investor in the Iraqi oil sector, as I said. So the economy would continue to depend on this foreign investment and trade with Turkey. That would not change. But how could an independent Kurdistan survive when there's only one country publicly supporting it? Even if the United States supported it, there's no chance it will become a UN member state. There's no chance of becoming, we'll go to the Olympics, or they will get IMF loans. The IMF has said they're only going to give loans to Baghdad. They won't give loans directly to Erbil. They'll have no international status whatsoever. Nothing will change in terms of how the economy is run. And how the political situation is here, which, is not wholly democratic either, we have to say. Barzani is going to have an election in November, by the way. So this referendum is certainly also intended to give him the support to finally be elected again. He's been holding office for 2 years after his term has ended. The parliament did not meet for 2 years until last week, when they approved this referendum. So there's no effective parliament in the country. There's a lot of corruption, as there is in most governments around the world, certainly in the Middle East. There's nepotism charges against him. His nephew is the prime minister. Will any of this change by becoming an independent country? No. The only thing that's going to change is they could be crushed economically now if Iraq and Turkey are stopped and they go ahead. So I don't see the point of this referendum other than to feel that they have defiantly told the world they are ready for independence, they want it, and that's all well and good. And many Kurds in Iraq, I was just communicating with someone in Erbil before I went on the air with you, and he said most people, they feel this was a victory. But it's a hollow victory because it doesn't change anything, and it only increases dangers to them.
One more question. I'm just reflecting on Ukraine and Yugoslavia and seeing how some of these ethnic and nationalistic passions can sometimes give way to tremendous political and economic upheaval and even bloodshed. What are the principal indicators that you will be watching for in relation to the Kurds in Iraq and other countries in the region in the weeks ahead?
Kirkuk in particular. That's where I think violence could start and could spread. If it could be avoided there, I think we will not see any bloodshed like we saw in Yugoslavia and in Ukraine. And I think how long an economic blockade, if it in fact is instituted, Erdogan talks a big game a lot, and he rarely follows up on it. So it's possible there is no economic blockade at all, that the business interests of Turkey are telling him not to do it. But if it does take place, how long will that remain in effect? Does it include oil? And what will that mean to the people of the Iraqi Kurdish region? Because without oil, within weeks, their economy will collapse, and there'll be really trouble there. And that could lead to bloodshed, too, out of desperation. So those are the two indicators, whether there's violence in Kirkuk and whether there really is an economic embargo and how long it may last.
Okay. Well, Joe Loria, I really appreciate your coming on. I know we've had a bit some communications clumsiness, but I want to thank you very much for making this interview work, and thank you so much for your time.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for thank you for allowing me to speak on this issue.
We've been speaking with Joe Loria, veteran foreign affairs journalist and author of a recent article, "Vote by Iraqi Kurds Adds to Tensions." He joined us from Cairo. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.